Health and Human Service Reform Committee will come to order. We do have a quorum. Representative Peterson moves the minutes from March 8th. Are there any additions, corrections, or changes to be made to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The minutes are adopted. First up today is House File 3240, Representative Haley. As she makes her way forward, I move that House File 3240 be referred to the Committee on HHS Finance. We have the bill in front of us, Representative Haley. I understand you have an A1 amendment.
Yes, good morning, Chair.
I will move the A1 amendment, Representative Haley, to your amendment.
Thank you very much. When the bill was first introduced, there were a few outstanding issues that needed to be resolved with the Department of Health and some providers. So that's what we did with the author's amendment. So unless there are any questions on that.
Are there any questions to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Representative Haley, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'll just give you a high level of House File 3240, and I'll allow Kevin to go into the details. Basically, this modifies some licensure requirements of home health care agencies in Minnesota. The bill was brought to me by the Minnesota Home Care Association on behalf of the providers and others with expertise on these issues, including Leading Age Minnesota and Care Providers of Minnesota. This is the culmination of over 5 months of work with these folks. Over the years, individuals involved with home care licensing have identified licensing statutes that were sometimes unclear, unworkable, or outdated. This caused questions as to what was expected for compliance and if the law would be applied consistently now and in the future. I'll just give you one short example. A statement about the supervision of direct care workers was required in the service agreement between the providers and the clients. This requirement was often cited as being in violation on surveys, simply because the provider failed to include it. It was determined that in many cases it was omitted because they just didn't understand that what was required. So there are other details in this bill, but it falls along the similar lines of just clearing up some of these licensure requirements. With the addition of the amendment, as I said, I'm not aware of any other opposition to the bill. And Kevin Goodnow is here on behalf of Minnesota Home Care Association, and he will walk you through the details of the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Thank you, Representative Haley. Mr. Goodnow, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kevin Goodnow here on behalf of the Minnesota Home Care Association. I appreciate the opportunity. There are 31 sections to this bill, but it's basically does about 11 different things with a few subparts. I'll try to go through those at kind of a medium level rather than get down into the weeds too much. But as Representative Haley mentioned, it really, this is a culmination of work. We have folks that kind of collect their biggest concerns when they're dealing with home care licensure statutes. They've accumulated that over a period of time. We came together with the Department of Health to reach agreement on how we can address those things. And in a lot of cases, it's just really clarifying existing statute or codifying existing practices. So when you look at Section 1, and actually there's 7 sections related to clarifications around medication administration. Those are found in Sections 1, 2, 19, 20, 21, 22, and 23. There's really no, again, substantial change there. It's just clarifying language. We have in 5 sections of the law the making it consistent that we use service agreement rather than service plan. Section 4 is just regarding a definition of standby assistance. This is actually a situation where we had come in with a different solution to this, and Department of Health said, you know what, your solution doesn't make sense. This is one of those things where people weren't understanding what standby assistance meant, and because of that misreading, they were actually needing to get a higher-level licensure than they actually needed in order to provide low-level services. So with this definition, it clarifies what's included as standby assistance and the fact that you need only a lower license rather than a comprehensive license. There are 5 sections in the bill related to change of ownership. This was a situation when a home care provider changes ownership. This clarifies the transition of the employee training from one owner to the next. It updates language and modernizes language with regard to entity structures. With LLCs and stuff like that, we wanted to be clear on what that meant. And also triggers a survey within a period of time, 6 months, with the change of ownership. There are about 8 different sections in the bill that relate to start of services. Some of that is just clarifying the language as to when start of service actually begins. You would think that'd be easy, but we spent an awful lot of time trying to be precise about that and making sure that it did not mean when the agreement was signed, but when there was actually a provision of service. That's important because it triggers a number of other things that happen after that provision of service starts. There also is, and we worked with the Department of Health as we were having these conversations, other issues were identified. And one of those is that when we have a new provider, they're issued a temporary license. They may not be serving anybody at the time they're issued the temporary license, but they're required to notify the Department of Health when they start actually providing services to individuals, and that triggers the requirement with a certain period of time that they actually have to be surveyed. There are a number of people that weren't complying with that law, so we've added, and this is just a note, a fee of $1,000 if you're not compliant with that timely notification. And our hope as providers is that when new providers come in, that they are surveyed in a timely manner after they start to provide services. We want to address any concerns that people have up front rather than after the fact. There's a couple provisions and sections in the law with regard to transition of clients if a home care provider has their license suspended or revoked. The current law is kind of silent on that, but you don't. And this is if the clients aren't facing life and safety issues. But we need to have an orderly transition from the old provider to a new provider for those folks. We just can't cut off service at any specific time. In the service, there's also three sections related to disease prevention and infection control. Really no new requirements here. It modernizes the language with regard to that and consolidates it in one section of law so it's easier to identify and find. In the service agreement, that's the agreement that's signed between the provider and the client. There are two issues that we asked for clarification on. Representative Haley mentioned one of those, where we just want to go with a clearer understanding what's required, so it's easier for people to comply, and then from MDH's perspective, it's easier for them to identify violators as well. And then there's a couple of sections just about clarifying when orientations, who has to be involved with the orientation section. That section is 24. When supervision applies, it's 25. Again, it's just technical clarifying language. In sections 27, 28, there's home care and assisted living program advisory council, some tweaks to that language as well. And finally, in section 29, there's the deletion of obsolete language that, it's obsolete. So I'll stand for any questions. I appreciate the opportunity to present the bill to you today.
Thank you, Mr. Goodnow. Are there any questions for Mr. Goodnow? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your time this morning. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 3240? If you could please make your way forward. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Josh Berg, Director of Services for Accessible Space, Inc., and former Program Manager at the Department of Health over the HCALP section. I'm full support of this proposal and this bill. Worked with Leading Age last year as we were kind of going through some of these details. Getting out front and being proactive to make sure that we're preventing these issues from happening in the first place is the key, and I think that's what a lot of this addresses, especially with the temporary license piece of this. I would encourage anybody to continue to talk about that piece of it and that preventative part, because I think there's more that can be done when it comes to prevention as far as getting out in front of before a license is ever even issued. The language really tightens it up and makes sure that a new temporary licensee gets surveyed within 90 days. But a lot can happen in 90 days. And a lot of these places take over a year to be built, and they have wait lists that are ready to go, so as soon as that license is issued, they are packed full of people already moving in. So I encourage you to look in the statutes, and it doesn't even need legislative changes. If you look at 144A473, subdivision 1, it gives the department authority to ensure that prior to issuing a temporary license, they make sure that applicant has the knowledge and can actually implement the regulations as they are there. So and when I was at the department, we tried out some different practices and tried out some different ways of doing that, and I'd be happy to discuss that with anybody. We have some good data to show that applicants self-selected out after they realized they were in over their heads and decided this wasn't for them, and they didn't want to be placing them at risk from a business perspective, and then taking care of vulnerable lives without having the knowledge and the understanding of the regs. So great bill. I think it's a really cool thing. It'll be interesting to see how this all plays out with timelines of surveys and everything, but we'll kind of let that be. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Berg. Questions for the testifier, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Berg. Thanks for your testimony. Just one further question. This addition of the fee of $1,000 for failing to comply with notification, what's your take on that? Is that something you feel like is that necessary? Is it not adequate? I mean, do you think, you know, how is that going to impact things from your point of view?
Mr. Berg.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I think it's great. I think it was one of those statutes that had no teeth behind it, no anything behind it, and from my perspective when I was at the department, and I'm sure even now there's so many providers that start providing services, fail to send in that notification, the department then doesn't have any idea, and then they're out there 6 months after they actually start providing services, and now they got 100 individuals living in their building. So I think this is a great start. Now, whether it'll incentivize or prevent it from happening, who knows, but it's something. So I think something was definitely needed.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you.
Any other questions for the testifier? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony today. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 3240? Seeing none, final questions from members? Seeing none, final word, Representative Haley.
I know you have a full agenda, Mr. Chair, so thank you for listening to the testimony, and I appreciate your support on the bill.
With that, I will renew my motion that House File 3240, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 3240, is as amended, is re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Thank you, Representative Haley. Up next this morning is House File 3061, Representative Dean. As he makes his way forward, Representative Dean moves that House File 3061 be re-referred to the General Register. Representative Dean, when you are ready, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill is a technical change from the Department of Health. This funds residency slots for primary care in the state. And what this bill does is it makes a small change with the existing grant appropriations to move from a three-year residency to a four-year residency. And what that does is it will enable psychiatry residents to take advantage of this. Psychiatry is a four-year residency, not a three-year residency, so this would allow psychiatry residents to be able to take advantage of this and would provide more primary care mental health providers within Minnesota for those slots. That's all the bill does. Doesn't spend any money, and that's why it's going to the General Register. Be happy to answer any questions. Also, anyone from any questions for the department, we do have somebody here from them. So with that, I'd entertain any questions. Appreciate support.
All right. Is there anyone who wishes to testify on House File 3061? Okay. Are there questions from members? Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Dean. Is this just for psychiatry?
Chair Dean.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, it is not. It is any residency within primary care, and those are family medicine, internal medicine, pediatrics, psychiatry, geriatrics, and general surgery.
Representative Liebling. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions for the bill author? Seeing none, final word, Representative Dean.
Appreciate your support.
With that, Representative Dean renews his motion that House File 3061 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 3061 is re-referred to the General Register. Next up this morning, Representative Keel. And House File 2987. As she makes her way forward, Representative Keel moves that House File 2987 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Public Safety. Welcome to the committee. Please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Chris Rowan came and joined me, or came to my office this summer and asked if I was interested in looking at a drug repository bill and helping to save some dollars cost in drugs that could be shared, I guess would be a comment. But with that, and I know how busy we are today, so I'm going to ask Rowan if she would explain to you what this bill does.
Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Hi, my name's Rowan Mann, and I am a pharmacy student and a public health student at the university, and I'm here today representing a student organization that brought this bill to Representative Keel. So basically, this bill looks at long-term care facilities. When a patient's there, they generally get their medications packaged individually for a few weeks. And if the patient doesn't need those medications anymore, if they get switched or if something happens and they no longer need those medications currently have to be thrown away. And that doesn't seem like it would be that big a deal, but in 2014, a study was conducted across the United States, and it was estimated that $2 billion worth of safe medications are being thrown away yearly at these long-term care facilities. Colorado did a state-specific study, and they found out of their 220 long-term care facilities, they were wasting $10 million worth of safe medications. For comparison, Minnesota has 365 long-term care facilities. So we're throwing away medications that are still safe, but there are still many patients who cannot afford medications. I work at North Memorial Hospital, and every shift I talk to at least one patient who is not taking their medications because they just can't afford them. So what a lot of states have done, what 20 other states have done, is they allow long-term care facilities to donate those safe medications that have just been repackaged for another patient and allowed them to be donated to a medication repository program that can then give those medications to patients who otherwise cannot afford them. This language was heavily modeled after Iowa, and Iowa's program has been running since 2018, and they've helped over 71,000 patients. They have been able to donate out over $17.7 million worth of medication since 2018. Wyoming is another great example. They've been operating since 2007. They have filled over 150,000 prescriptions worth over $12.5 million. This piece of legislation is supported by the Board of Pharmacy, the Minnesota Public Health Association, and the Minnesota Nursing Association. And Dr. Weiberg of the Board of Pharmacy actually helped rewrite this entire piece of legislation. Are there any questions?
All right. And before we move to questions to the testifier, Representative Keel, you have two technical amendments to get the bill into the order that you wish to present it. Representative Keel moves the A4 amendment. Representative Keel, to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A4 was just to, like you said, technical amendment that would clean up some details in the for the drug manufacturers or the prescription drugs that would be dispensed.
Are there any questions on the A4 amendment? Mr. Chung.
Mr. Chair, if the A3-1 amendment is to be adopted, then on the A4, staff would suggest deleting lines 14 and 15. They amend the same lines of the bill.
Okay. Representative Keel, do you wish to make an oral amendment to strike lines 1.14 and 1.15?
Yes. Absolutely.
All right. Are there any questions on that oral amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the oral amendment to strike on the A4 amendment lines 1.14 and 1.15, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted to the A4 amendment. Are there any questions to the A4 amendment as amended? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A4 amendment as amended, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The amendment as amended is adopted. Representative Keel moves the A3-1 amendment.
Correct.
Representative Keel, to your amendment.
Just cleans up some language that after some discussion needed to be. And I don't know if Mr. Chung would like to add to that or not.
Sure.
Mr. Chung.
Mr. Chair and members, this amendment clarifies that if you have a if you have prescription drug coverage, then you would not be eligible to participate in the donation program, and instead you would go through the health plan's formulary exception process.
Questions for Representative Keel on the A3-1 amendment. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, thank you very much for bringing this forward, and you can see I'm a co-author on the bill. But what Mr. Chun just explained, I have a question about that, because lately we've been hearing a lot about some people have prescription coverage, but they actually end up paying more under that coverage than they would, sometimes for a drug if they didn't have the coverage. You know what I'm talking about? Mr. Chun, maybe Mr. Chun can kind of address this because of the change that you just described, that under this amendment, that if we adopt this amendment, the bill wouldn't apply if you have prescription drug coverage. I think that was what I understood you to say.
Mr. Chun. Yes, that's correct. The bill, I guess, doesn't affect, you know, those situations perhaps where the patient ends up paying more, because of a higher copay, for example. It doesn't address that issue. It just addresses who's eligible for the donated drugs.
Right. So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
So maybe Mr. Chun could best answer this then, or if the testifier can answer it. So would this not then, that part of it, hurt people who have coverage but have coverage that, is expensive for them in terms of the copay for the drugs they need?
Mr. Chung.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I think it would depend on the drug coverage, and I guess if a person did have drug coverage policy that perhaps wasn't very favorable for them or didn't cover very many drugs, then they would perhaps be hurt by this provision. This is a provision that I think was kind of worked on or requested by some of the health plans, and they might be able to answer some of these questions as well.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I see Ms. Commit just came to the table to do just that.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Commit. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Catherine Commit, and I'm here for the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. And thank you for the consideration of this amendment. Essentially what it would do is fix the language. We were concerned that it would allow individuals who have health insurance, including drug coverage, to bypass the formulary and the formulary exceptions process. So we think what this bill is really designed to do is to help people who don't have insurance and can't access these medications to be able to have a way to access those medications. But for people who have insurance, we want to be sure that they are able to use the formulary process that exists today.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, able to use the formulary process. So from the patient's point of view, what does it mean to be able to use the formulary process?
Ms. Commit.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Liebling. So I think what you might be getting at is it affordable? And that certainly is a public policy issue that we all are struggling with. Is drug coverage affordable? Certainly drugs are very, very expensive. But when somebody has coverage through a health insurance plan, they should be able to call up their carrier or work with their physician or provider to be able to get an exception to a formulary or to look at the formulary to see what the drugs are that are covered for a particular class of drugs. So they do have, most people have coverage. We were struggling to figure out who would buy coverage or what employer out there in Minnesota would possibly offer coverage to their employees without drug coverage, and we cannot think of anybody who would do it. So I think nearly everyone who has coverage today it has drug coverage.
Representative Liebling.
So, Mr. Chair and members, I did not really hear an answer to my question. We know that a lot of people have drug coverage that's really inadequate, that they end up spending a lot of money on their drugs. And I do not understand. I mean, I think this bill is a great idea. And I do not understand why, because somebody has drug coverage, that they should not be able to use this program in a case where their drug coverage could be very expensive for them. So you said there, you know, that it's, you know, something about bypassing the formulary, and I really don't understand how it will benefit patients to be exempted from this bill if they have pharmaceutical coverage. I don't understand that. Maybe the bill author could come, or the testifier could come back to the table and explain to me if she knows, or maybe Representative Keel.
A follow-up, Ms. Commit.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Liebling. What we don't want to have is people who already have coverage to go outside of that process, try to get a particular drug through the drug repository program, and end up being on that drug and then wanting to come back in. And it just creates so many different problems. People have drug coverage. People who are insured typically have drug coverage, and there are processes in place in order for them to be able to access those drugs. And if it's not the right drug, to look at a formulary exceptions process and that sort of thing. With respect to the question about how expensive drugs are, I agree with you. They're really, really expensive. And unfortunately, more and more products that are out there look at trying to share some of those costs with enrollees. We've got to do something about drug costs, so I agree with you about that. But for people who are insured, they have coverage, and it's best if they work through that process in order to ensure that they remain within the system and that their care can continue to be coordinated.
Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, this is I think this bears a lot more discussion. This is an amendment to the bill. I assume that this came in probably at the request of the health plans. I'd really like to hear what the author has to say about it, and more importantly, even what the proponent of the bill has to say about this, because I don't think this was in the original. This was part of the original idea, and maybe you could tell us, you know, what other states are doing with regard to this issue.
Ms. Mann, welcome back to the committee. Go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Representative Schumacher. So I was just talking to Dr. Weiberg about this, and no, this was not in the original draft of the legislation. I do not believe that it needs to be in there, but I also do understand the point of it. There will be a limited supply, especially at the beginning, of medications. It takes a while to get these. As Iowa or Wyoming, each year they get more donations, and each year they have a more powerful program. So there will be a limited number of medications to begin with, and making sure that those go to the patients who have no safety net at all, that would be very important to this bill, and kind of is what this bill is trying to do. In Iowa's language, they actually rank it out, so where the first line of individuals would be the ones who have no health insurance, and then they go down to number two of the patients who cannot afford them with their insurance. So that's how other states have done it, and that is
Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for that explanation. So, say in Iowa, so you have a priority if you have no coverage. That's certainly understandable. But we know there are many patients who have coverage and still can't afford. And so, to me, it just makes no sense at all to just exempt those and say they can't use the program. So, I mean, I've just, from what I've heard here today on this, I'm going to oppose this amendment. You know, if other members decide that it's okay to exempt people who, just because they have coverage, whether or not they can actually afford their drugs, then, you know, I hope we can work on this going forward, because I think it's a very good bill, and I just don't see a reason, you know, notwithstanding that obviously the health plans don't want this in there for reasons that are still a little bit opaque to me. I think that I don't think we should put this amendment on.
I think that we should rank them if we need an amendment for it.
Okay. Representative Keel?
Mr. Chair and members, you know, part of this is not creating an incentive. We don't want to create an incentive for people to go outside of their coverage, and that's the reason for the amendment. in my mind.
Any further discussion on the A3-1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A3-1 amendment signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign.
No.
The A3-1 amendment is adopted. Representative Keel, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe that as it stands now, this would be a very effective help for people who are looking for medicine. As Rowan explained, keeping our citizens who, especially our seniors who need to make sure that they have access to medicine, and especially when they can't afford it, helps to make them available for them. And with that, I guess I would ask you to support the amendment.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 2987? Seeing none, final questions from members. Final word, Representative Keel.
Please support the bill.
With that, Representative Keel renews her motion on House File 2987 as amended. Be referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Public Safety. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 2987 as amended is referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Public Safety.
Thank you.
All right, next up is House File 2919.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to get up and leave, but I'll stick around.
And members, for clarification, we'll get that fixed. 2919. All right, Representative Keel moves on House File 2919 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Representative Keel, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I thank you for putting this in this order. I had I'm been honored to have my public health director from Polk County join me today. This just expands a little bit telemedicine. I really think that this is a important and very helpful for rural Minnesota, how we can help our friends and neighbors that are a little farther away and be consistent about their health care. With that, I will ask... I can't remember. Do we have an amendment that we need to pass here? Maybe you'd like to do that before we hear the
Representative Keel moves the A2-1 amendment. Representative Keel, to your amendment.
This gave some comfort to the county paramedics, and if you would like to hear from them, Mr. McAlpin, I believe, is here. Right behind me, as far as how they address the telemedicine issues. So,
Mr. McAlpin, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members, Buck McAlpin on behalf of the Minnesota Ambulance Association. We were also looking at doing this session with our community paramedics across the state, and we're somewhat like the community health workers where we're certified and work under a scope of training and don't have a scope of practice. And the other licensing boards have scope of practices. So when the community health worker bill popped up, we went and visited with Representative Keel about amending the community paramedics into the telehealth option too. You'll hear another bill Thursday that Representative Dean has. We're doing lots of work around trying to look at addressing the opioid crisis and our chronic care management. And we find when patients come into the healthcare system, they leave long distances outside of the metro, and there's ways we could use our telehealth to have some of our community paramedics follow up with these folks. So we'd appreciate the support to the amendment to add them into this bill, too.
Are there any questions for the A2-1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A2-1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Representative Keel, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 2919 revises the telemedicine statute to allow local public health providers to bill MA more than three times per week per enrollee for telemedicine services provided to the treat and control infectious disease. It also adds certified community health workers to the list of eligible telemedicine providers. With that, I will ask Ms. Reese. I'm sorry, I've known her since she was a young kid, so I have to stop and think about her last name. Anyway, to testify.
All right, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Mr. Chair and committee, my name is Sarah Reese, and I am the Polk Norman Minoman Community Health Services Administrator and the Polk County Public Health Director. Today I'm here on behalf of our Community Health Board and our local public health department in Polk County, as well as representing the local public health association. Our association, or LPHA for short, represents 220 public health directors, supervisors, and community health administrators from public health departments across the state of Minnesota. Today I'm here in support of House File 2919. This makes small changes to the telemedicine statute to support the treatment and control of infectious disease, one of the cornerstones of our role in public health. I would like to thank the committee and Representative Keel for her leadership on this issue. Local public health is mandated by state statute to prevent the spread of infectious disease. For diseases like tuberculosis or TB, this can require daily, directly observed therapy, sometimes taking 6 months or greater. Known as DOT, this means that a public health nurse or a community health worker must meet with the patient daily and see them taking a pill. People from all different educational backgrounds, ages, gender, race, and ethnicity can have problems taking medications correctly. The intent of our work is to increase the likeliness that treatment is completed successfully and on time, to prevent the transmission to others, and decrease the risk of drug-resistant TB while meeting state statute to prevent the spread of infectious disease. The staff time and related expenses for this type of treatment add up quite quickly. For example, in 2017, 10% of our Polk County Public Health Agency budget for disease control and prevention was used for tuberculosis. In rural areas of the state, geographic distance and workforce shortages pose additional challenges to us providing treatment. Telemedicine provides local public health with a unique opportunity to innovate our service delivery by allowing qualified staff to witness DOT virtually. In short, providing the same service provided through a more safer and efficient method. Eliminating the need for daily travel, sometimes 45 minutes or miles in one way, public health staff save time on travel expenses, and it frees us up to see other clients. Scheduling also becomes more convenient for our clients, too, because one way or another, we have to see them. These benefits, however, are limited by the current telemedicine statute, which limits the billable visits to 3 per week per enrollee. So if we use a telemedicine model, we can currently bill 3 times per week per enrollee. It also excludes community health workers. These are people who understand the experiences, language, and culture of the populations that they serve, and that makes them key service providers. The bill before you seeks to do two things. First, to remove the 3 visit per week coverage limit for services provided for the treatment and control of infectious disease, and second, to add certified community health workers to the list of eligible providers. Currently, local public health providers, our very own public health nurses, are able to provide up to 7 days per week for services like DOT, assuming that they are provided in person. This is used to treat and control infectious disease like TB that I was mentioning. And certified community health workers are currently eligible to bill medical assistant assistance for in-person visits as well. In this way, the bill does not expand or change the services that are billed or by who, just how they can be provided using a virtual method. This is a good bill for rural Minnesota and Polk County. This bill is not looking to add anything that is not already billable. These small changes would promote cost and staffing efficiencies and reduce barriers to treatment that would better support our local public health efforts to prevent the spread of infectious disease. We ask for your support, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have. Thank you.
Questions for Ms. Reese? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much for your testimony. I just want to be really clear, the addition of the community health workers and the EMS people, is that just for purposes of this infectious disease telemedicine, or does that have broader applicability under the bill?
Ms. Reese. Mr. McAlpin.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, Buck McAlpin at the Ambulance Association. Representative Liebling, it would be for chronic care management, following up with patients, everything that we're allowed currently to do under the medical assistance piece where we're paid under 256B for services.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I just kind of remember when we started to allow this in the first place. And I thought the point was that these people are widely distributed in greater Minnesota and could get there and be there with a patient, whereas otherwise they might not get service. And now we're saying, well, it's okay for them to now provide their service through telemedicine. So I don't know. That just seems like kind of goes against the original purpose.
Mr. McAlpin.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling. I think we always prefer to have face-to-face visits. There's about 250 community paramedics, give or take, across Minnesota now. All the major healthcare systems have them, from Rochester and North Memorial, Health East, Hennepin County, Alina. They're pretty dispersed, and systems like Staples and them, so they do prefer that. But what we're running into, like anything, is we're just seeing large number of patients that we're visiting quite often, some daily. And they just require so much contact that the CPs thought that the telehealth was another great option, because lots of it's simple questions that would save them driving 35 miles to answer a question about a medication or how much insulin they should drop if they don't understand their vial and syringe and things like that.
Representative Lee.
So, Mr. Chair and to the testifier, yeah, I mean, I get that. I mean, it's easier to do it by telemedicine, but I mean, the whole purpose of allowing community paramedics to do it was to be able to get there, I thought, and that we didn't have enough, say, nurses. I mean, I kind of remember this whole fight about who should be able to provide this service, and I think the argument was, you know, if we had community paramedics doing it, we were able to get to people. So I just want to kind of put that out there. Is there, maybe to Representative Keel, is there maybe other testifiers are going to come down, but is there anybody who's opposed to this bill?
Representative Keel.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, not that I'm aware of. I think we have to think in terms of, it isn't that they're never going to be seen by somebody in person. It is that it saves some of those days of distant driving, and for the sparse staff we have in rural Minnesota, it really helps them to make sure that they can answer probably more than, I'm sure that it is challenging to get to everybody on a given day. And so this helps for some of the patients some of the time. Maybe Ms. Reese wants to also reply.
Ms. Reese.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling and committee, our public health nurses, when we provide directly observed therapy or DOT, we are seeing these patients for 6 months and generally up to a year. And so this provides an opportunity for patients to meet with us at a convenient schedule that's good for them. It's a service that we're already providing. We already can bill for up to 7 days of in-person contact. So individuals who are following their prescribed medications, this is a really convenient way for them to quickly be able to follow through with their medication regimen to finish their treatment timely, prevent transmission to others, and also decrease their risk for drug-resistant TB.
Any other questions, Representative Liebling?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, thank you for that. I mean, I have no problem with that. We had a presentation on drug-resistant TB, and it's a huge problem. I mean, I think I'm absolutely on board with that part of this. Mm-hmm. But the other piece of this, as we was just explained, is that, you know, telemedicine now is being made available for use by community paramedics generally, not just for this purpose. And that's kind of the thing that I'm raising as an issue. But, you know, maybe we can kind of continue to talk about that. But sometimes one thing kind of gets piggybacked onto another thing, and I think that's what's happening here. It's a great bill, you know, in the sense that, you know, for this, I think it's super important to make sure we get compliance. I mean, we heard, you didn't talk about it today, but we heard from the Department of Health the other day about the incredible cost of drug-resistant TB and how long you have to treat people. I think it was like 3 years sometimes. And if they're not taking those medications, it's a serious public health impact, and a lot of that's in greater Minnesota and so on. So I think this is a great bill to respond to that. I have absolutely no problem with what you're describing. I just don't know if we want to also bootstrap in here letting community paramedics use telemedicine for every purpose, and that's what I understand the bill is also doing. So just wanted to flag that. But, you know, I'm obviously not going to oppose the bill for that reason, but I think we need to continue to talk about that.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was answered. Thank you.
All right. Are there any other questions for the testifiers? Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 2919? Final questions for the bill author members. Final word, Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I would really appreciate the support for this bill. I really think that it will promote efficiency, cost efficiencies, and reduce barriers to treatment at a local level, especially in our rural areas of Minnesota. So thank you with that.
With that, Representative Keel renews her motion that House File 2919, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 2919, as amended, is re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Next up, members, we're going to do a series of bills from me, House File 3191, then House File 3193, and then House File 3169.
The next bill on the agenda is House File 3191. Chair Schumacher moves House File 3191 to be re-referred to the Committee on HHS Finance. Chair Schumacher, I understand that you have an A1 amendment. Is an author's amendment? Would you like to move that amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will move the A1 amendment. This amendment reflects the recent federal direction on the 7% rate cuts, and we use this amendment as a way to stop that.
Any discussion on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign? The amendment passes. Representative Schumacher, please give a brief explanation of your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill, as amended, stops future 7% rate cuts from the individual rates and adds stability to the rate system moving forward. The legislation introduces the competitive workforce factor that is added to the rate framework. This factor is based on analysis that shows that wages of direct support professionals lag behind others with similar training and education by about 11%. The factor value in this legislation is 8.35%, the level necessary to restore the 7% rate cut, but does not address the entire wage disparity. This bill also adds stability and predictability to the rate system by moving from inflationary adjustments every 5 years to every 2 years and eliminating the regional variance factor beginning in 2022. This legislation was brought to me by the Best Life Alliance, and that includes a broad range of disability advocates and provider groups. And we do have a couple testifiers today. Mr. Chair, first it looks like Mr. Goodnow.
Mr. Goodnow, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and give us your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Kevin Goodnow, representing the Minnesota Organization for Habilitation and Rehabilitation and also the broader coalition of the Best Life Alliance. Just to give you a little context about the bill, this is a result of a couple months of work with the Best Life Alliance in talking to the Department of Human Services and receiving technical assistance from them on how to best embed the 7% rate within the rate frameworks. If just to maybe give people a little bit more context, the rates that what I'm talking about when we talk about rate frameworks, we're talking about the rate setting methodology that sets the rates for services provided under waivered services for people with disabilities. That was a system that was put into place in starting in, the implementation was 2014, and we've been modifying it as we go forward. One of the issues we identified last session is we should embed the rates. This became a more urgent a few weeks ago when the federal government decided or directed that they would not allow the 7% add-on onto the rate frameworks. And so this is a solution to that rate cut. Right now under current law, on July 1st, 27% of the individuals who are served under the DWRS system or whose rates are determined by the rates, DWRS system will see a 7% rate cut in their rates. And for the remaining 73%, they'll see that when banding comes off at the end of 2019 or 2020, depending upon if we get the seventh year of banding. So this is a solution to that problem. Representative Schumacher did a good job of identifying the three elements that we're looking at in order to, first of all, stop the cut, but also add additional stability to the system. With that, I appreciate the opportunity to speak, and we do have some other folks to testify on behalf of the coalition.
Chair Schumacher, do you have other testifiers?
We do. I believe up next we have Lynn Noren, who is the president of RISE Incorporated.
Members, we'll go through the testifiers, and then if you have questions, you can recall them back to the desk.
Mr. Chair, members.
Please introduce yourself and welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lynn Noren, president of RISE Incorporated, which is a nonprofit organization that serves nearly 3,000 people with disabilities throughout the Twin Cities metropolitan area and across central Minnesota. I've been heavily involved in the DWRS rate setting issue since 2010 as part of that state's advisory committee. My organization is also a member of MORE and part of the Best Life Alliance. At our organization, over half of our budget comes from Medicaid funds that are paid through the disability waiver rate setting process. The 7% reduction required by CMS and outlined in the letter that you received from DHS would be a reduction to our budget of over $850,000. It's not possible to adjust for that significant of a cut without drastic reductions in staffing and benefits. As a community of organizations serving Minnesotans with disabilities, we worked really hard to gain those rate increases involving the people we serve, their families, our team members, and other advocacy organizations. Those increases were hard fought at the legislature with hours of meetings, testimony, and discussion. We engaged in this difficult advocacy year after year because we believe our state needs a disability waiver rate setting process that first supports people who have disabilities in living their best lives possible and that recognizes the incredible value of the staff that provide these services day after day in every part of our state. To have all of those efforts eliminated in action that was unexpected and without open discussion was very disheartening to providers and other community-based service stakeholders. I cannot imagine going back to my team members at RISE and the people we serve to share the news about how this will impact our services. All increases that we receive at the legislature go primarily to increasing wages and benefits at RISE. Unlike other businesses, we have no influence over our pricing. except by action of the legislature. Even with the adjustments that we've made since 2013, we remain in a crisis in terms of workforce. At RISE in 2017, we had over 40% turnover in our direct support roles. This constant churn of employees has an impact on the quality of services that we all can provide. In my 38 years at RISE, I've never seen as challenging a time related to workforce as we are in today. I feel confident that we can work out a solution that is data-driven to meet the requirements of CMS. The Best Life Alliance has already been meeting with the department to develop potential solutions. We will need your partnership and support and action to assure that needed resources are in place for a disability waiver rate system that is so integral to our ability to offer access to high-quality community-based services to people in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Tip, for your testimony, Ms. Noreen. Chair Schumacher, do you have another testifier?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The last testifier we have today is Paula Hart from Volunteers of America.
Well, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and give your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Paula Hart, and I'm President and CEO of Volunteers of America, Minnesota. We have been providing community health and human services in the state for 122 years this month. We are also a longtime member of ARM and a member of the Best Life Alliance. We serve 26,000 Minnesotans every year, and many of those are people with disabilities who would be affected if this bill is not passed. So I'm here this morning to support House File 3191 as amended. As Ms. Noren said, the majority of our rates go to support the professionals who in turn support people with disabilities. We would ultimately be cut $400,000 annually, and the majority of that would need to come out of wages and benefits if this amended bill is not approved. I have long-term direct support professionals who tell me today that they could go to the corner fast food place, I won't name them by name, and make more than they make after working for decades supporting people with disabilities. We cannot make this situation even worse. We have retailers who are sending out bonuses and increasing their starting rate to $15 an hour when our starting rate is $11 or $12. There is no way that we can take another $400,000 out of the pockets of these very, very dedicated direct support professionals. So I urge you to stop the cut and support House File 3191 as amended, and appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Hart. Chair Schumacher, any additional testifiers?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That concludes my presentation.
Okay, with that, members, any questions for the testifiers at this point? Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I think this is a good deal, but I just want to reiterate what we just heard from the testifier, that this increase goes to the workers. They deserve it. They're hardworking, and they need to take care of their families also. So my hope is that we look at the workers, not shareholders and other folks, and that we give them a much-deserved increase. Thank you.
Any other questions, members? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, Representative Liebling, I understand you have an A2 amendment. Would you like to offer that amendment?
I would, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I would move the A2 amendment.
Representative Liebling moves the A2 amendment. Do you want to give a brief explanation of your, would you like to brief us on? I'd like to keep it brief, too. But
I will present the amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Right. So this is an amendment that I think everybody on this committee really is extremely sympathetic to the problems that the testifiers have just presented. The problem of low wages for people who care for those with disabilities is really acute. And, we are in a situation right now, I have to say, in our entire economy when lots and lots of people are not making enough money to live on. And we have shortages of workers across many, many industries. I mean, we hear this everywhere across the state that people are struggling to find employees, but it's especially concerning in the area of support for people with disabilities where, you know, in many cases it's actually a matter of life and death whether somebody has a person there to support them and has the skills and the knowledge to interact with them. And so we completely get this. At the same time, from what I understand, the Department of Human Services is not able to really provide data to help us understand where the worst shortages are occurring, how much people are actually earning. And when we do things like we're trying to do with this bill and make sure that we're properly compensating these people, we really don't have any way as a legislature of knowing what gets passed through to the workers and to really be able to deal with the problem, as they say, maybe with more of a scalpel instead of a hatchet, so that we can actually, it's kind of the wrong analogy because we don't want to cut anything. We want to add. Maybe we want to add with tweezers instead of a bucket, put it that way. So what this amendment does is it requires these agencies to just do some additional reporting so that the Department of Human Services can have better data for us as we go forward. And, I know it's never nothing to ask people to do more reporting. It takes some work to do some reporting. But we as a state spend billions of dollars doing this kind of work. And I think I'm not complaining about that. I think most Minnesotans really are proud of the fact that we support people with disabilities and we support elderly people and we have these waiver programs. I think it's one of the great things about Minnesota. But at the same time, we have a fiduciary responsibility to try to use the money where we need it the most and make sure that we're providing these services. So that's what I'm doing with this amendment. This has come forward before as part of other packages, and it originally actually grows out of a report that the OLA did for us, I think about a year ago, and it was kind of a recommendation that they had made and was worked on. I think the OLA and the Department of Human Services had the items that are in this amendment, I didn't make them up. They came from, I think they came from the Department of Human Services and the OLA. So anyway, so that's the amendment, members. And I'd like to hear what Representative Schumacher has to say.
Thank you, Representative Liebling, for explaining your amendment. Chair Schumacher, do you have any comments on the A2 amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And while I agree with quite a few of the points that Representative Liebling had made on this, I do see this as a mandate onto the providers at this point, and without a funding or an extra funding boost from it, it would be more in the lines of an unfunded mandate. So I would ask that you oppose the amendment.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. Any other discussion, members, on the A2 amendment? Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess, an unfunded mandate. Boy, Representative Schumacher, we're funding these people. We're funding them a lot. And I think that when they're getting public money, and I'm not complaining, as I said. I know a lot of them are really struggling. But the testifier from Volunteers of America just told us they support 26,000 people. And the majority of their money goes to support these people who are supporting. I think that was her clients, right? That was the number of clients, 26,000.
All 26,000. Some of whom are people with disabilities.
Okay, some of whom are people with disabilities. Okay, but when we've got these are enormous operations in some cases, and some of them are nonprofits, some of them are for-profits. We just don't have a handle on where this money is going. And so, Mr. Chair, I think this is so important that I would like to ask for a roll call on this amendment.
Roll call has been requested. There will be a roll call. Yep, we still have discussion. Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I was sort of shocked and amazed that the author of this amendment said we're funding them a lot. Ask the people that are working out there, we're funding them a lot. I know we spend a lot of money in HHS, but I think looking at ways to decrease the burden of the mandates where we can increase efficiency to where they don't have to be spending all these hours doing the paperwork and et cetera would open up, you know, maybe a little bit more of the money that we're apparently spending a lot to actually go to the workers. So I guess you'll find out what my vote will be on this amendment.
Okay, Representative McDonald has nothing to say. Oh, Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and perhaps somebody wants to comment, but with regard to the information that is being requested in this amendment, and it sounds like this is an outgrowth of some work that and recommendations that we saw from the Office of the Legislative Auditor about managing these public dollars. And the goal of that, I think everybody has stated here, of making sure that workers are benefiting from any increases that we pass along, which I think are vitally important increases. It seems to me that the information that's being asked for is information that employers would have. It doesn't seem like it's we're asking for any information that they wouldn't have. They know what they pay their workers. They know the number of hours people worked. They know what their retention rates are. They know what they pay in benefits, and they know what they pay in overtime. So it seems like this is information that they would already have and would be able to pass along so that the DHS and the legislature would have an idea of how this is having, how these increases are having an impact, and if they're having the desired impact that we're all looking for, which is to reduce vacancy rates and improve the economic benefits to the workers in this situation. So if anyone wants to comment on that, I think that would be helpful.
Any other discussion on the A2 amendment? Seeing none. Oh, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Halverson, for that. You know, last night, the Ways and Means Committee met, and we had a lot of discussion about MNLARS, right? And the Republican majority put forward a bill that was extremely detailed, trying to, the folks who are working to try to fix MNLARS, giving them very specific marching orders as a way to try to get control over what's happening in that area. And the testimony was that it was so detailed that it was going to actually impede fixing the problem. But that didn't deter the majority. Here we've got a situation where we're spending a ton of public dollars, and we all agree that we want to get those services out to the people that need them. All of us agree on that. But you all, or I don't know, maybe some of you are going to vote with me, I don't know, but it appears that the chair is really not that interested in making sure that we actually know where the money is going. That's all this does. And if we put this on the bill, we can continue to work and, you know, hear from people if there are particular items here that are too burdensome, if they don't have the data, as Representative Halverson is talking about. But it just frankly blows my mind that the people who put themselves forward as fiscal conservatives who want to shrink government, this is a huge item of spending for the state. And we want to make sure the services are provided, but my gosh, we better make sure that we know where the money is going. And this is just a tool to help us know that. It just, you know, we talk about this all the time that these folks are underpaid, but maybe some of them are underpaid and others aren't. We don't have any way of knowing. We don't have any way of directing our additional funds to the places where it may be most needed. You know, who knows what we may find out from this? We may find out there are certain regions of the state that are hurting more than other places. It may be your very own district that's getting shorted in some way, and you wouldn't even know it. So I just think members, I mean, I feel it's unfortunate to have a roll call on it, something like this, because we should just have, you know, we should have agreement around this. So I don't know, Mr. Chair, I mean, is this something, I guess I'd like to ask the chair, you know, is this something that we could continue to work on going forward and actually, you know, would you be open to this? If we remove the roll call, can we, you know, this is going to finance, I believe. So there's another opportunity to continue to work on this. But I just can't believe that the party of fiscal responsibility, so-called, doesn't want to find out where our money is going.
Chair Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling. I would be interested in continuing the conversation. I would prefer that the amendment not go on this bill, but if we were to work on things as it goes forward to Health and Human Service Finance, I think we could find a workable amendment to bring on there for you to offer.
Representative Liebling.
Okay, well, with that assurance, Mr. Chair, I will remove the roll call. But I really, you know, I'm not guaranteeing that I won't bring an amendment on the floor or so on if we don't, in fact, do something about this, because, you know, we will never have enough money in this state to spend it where we don't know where it's going. And I know that's hard in a lot of the things we do. And this is, you know, these kinds of services are very complicated. I think few of us actually totally understand how this whole system is working. But, you know, I think we all owe it to our constituents and to the people who are receiving the services to fully understand, because our constituents think that we're in charge. And then are we? If we don't know where the money's going, I don't think we really are in charge. So I will remove the roll call, Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling removes her roll call. We do have one additional member who has a question, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As it relates to the discussion on the amendment and how this is going to move forward, would the bill author, would Representative Schumacher, would you be able to just point to some places where you do see with the bill as it stands, if we don't accept this amendment, where there are guardrails in place to make sure that point to wherever, you know, you see that it's satisfactory and believing that the satisfactory guardrails and sort of the checks and balances and accountability are currently in the bill that make sure that the wage increases go directly to the workers?
Chair Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Olson. I would have to review the bill again to make sure on some of those points, but I would also refer to the A1 amendment on page 9, that there are references on reporting to know where the money went.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just share the similar concerns raised by Representative Liebling with her amendment, that I do hope that we have continued discussion then if this amendment does not go on, to make sure that we have more of a robust discussion to make sure that we are, in fact, making sure these wages go where they need to go to the folks doing the work.
Thank you, Representative Oakland. With that, Representative Liebling renews her motion to adopt the A2 amendment. All those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no.
No.
No. The amendment fails. Any further discussion on the bill, members? Seeing none, any final comments, Representative Schumacher?
No.
With that, Representative Chair Schumacher renews his motion on HF 3191 as amended to be referred to the Committee on HHS Finance. Those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed to the motion, same sign. Hearing none, the amendment passes.
Thank you, members.
Motion prevails. With that, we can move on to the next bill. Oh, House File 3191, as amended, is referred to the Committee on HHS Finance. With that, we have House File 3193. Representative Schumacher moves House File 3193 to be referred to the Committee on HHS Finance. Representative Schumacher, I understand the DE amendment is an author's amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the DE-1 amendment.
Representative Schumacher moves the DE-1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Oh, we want to have testimony first. Okay. Representative Schumacher, do you have a testifier?
Yes. I'll have Ms. Noren present on this amendment as well.
Ms. Noren, please introduce yourself and give your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, I'm Lynn Noren, and I'm the president of an organization called RISE. I won't go through all of that again, but we are very excited about the new employment rates that were passed last session. Our state organization, MORE, worked very closely with the Department of Human Services and other community organizations to advocate for these new services. The employment exploration, development, and support rates will assist people that we serve in having the support they need to achieve community employment. There are, however, a few challenges that require more time for implementation. The department's work plan called for a 6-month phase-in of training and planning once the approval of the new rates was completed by CMS. At this point, the rates have not been approved by CMS, and we don't believe the necessary infrastructure is in place to support a smooth transition. Our concerns relate to taking the time needed to assure the implementation goes well. An example of our concerns is the overlap in services today between these new employment services and day training and habilitation. Some individuals today have jobs as part of their day when they receive DT&H services. And immediately upon implementation of the new rates, banding ends for the providers, DT&H rates. For many providers, this will be a significant decrease in funding with no change in the service to the person served. Providers need more time to plan and adjust to the changing rate structure. We also feel really strongly that more time is needed for service planning to assure that lead agencies have the training and information they need and are ready to correctly authorize the new services. We are advocating to use a transition period for implementation of the new services so that we can be sure that it's done in a thoughtful and strategic way. We are committed to our collaborative work with the department to work through the process details necessary to ensure that these new employment services end up being viable option for Minnesotans with disabilities as they work toward their employment goals. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, any discussion on the DE amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. The DE amendment is adopted. Representative Schumacher, please give a explanation of your bill as amended.
Thank you, members, and thank you for adopting the DE-1 amendment. That amendment worked with the transitional period for employment services, and rather than changing the effective date as the original bill had, the bill brought forward, of course, with more in mind with this, as you just heard the testimony there. The bill proposes transition periods for the implementation of new employment services under the DWRS system for individuals that have banded rates for day training and habilitation. Those additional services are options available to Minnesotans with disabilities working towards their employment goals. However, the transition is complex and related to how services are billed and how they are authorized, and is even more complex when we're working between the banded and unbanded rates. In an effort to ensure the transition to these new employment services happens in a thoughtful and strategic manner, this bill proposes to stagger the implementation of these new services.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher, for your testimony and explanation. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing none, members, any discussions? Any questions for the author or the testifier? Seeing none, any final comments, Chair Schumacher? Okay, thank you, Chair Schumacher. He renews his motion that HF 3193, as amended, be referred to the Committee on HHS Finance. Those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails.
Thank you, members.
HF 3193, as amended, is referred to the Committee on HHS Finance. Okay, the next bill on the agenda is House File 3169. Representative or Chair Schumacher moves HF 3169 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data data practices policy. Chair Schumacher, please give a brief explanation of your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill is just me today. What it does is it adjusts the background study requirements, as you can read from the bill summary. What we're trying to do here is reflect what child development research has told us about children and the process of background checks and fingerprinting. And so what we've learned is that process makes children feel like criminals in their own homes because they can't differentiate between the fact that they're getting fingerprinted and that they did something wrong, even though they hadn't done anything wrong. And the studies have shown that this has increased the psychological issues that come through in the development process, and it is increasingly difficult for children who already have some type of issues that they're dealing with and have been adopted through the foster care program and have been adopted so that they are just residents in the home and not foster children in the home, that these background studies and the fingerprinting just adds to their stress and the things that they're dealing with. And so I would ask members for your support.
Chair Schumacher, do you have any testifiers?
No.
Okay. With that, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on the bill? Seeing none, members, any discussion? Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Schumacher, can you say more about the studies that you are citing with regard to the reactions of children to this action?
Mr. Chair, Representative Halverson, I don't have those studies with me today.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Halverson?
Can you say where they were from, or were they peer-reviewed, or who conducted the studies?
I can get back to you on that.
Okay. Any other questions, members? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Representative Schumacher. I guess I'd just like to understand a little more about this. You said you don't have any testifiers on this today?
That is correct, Representative Liebling.
And, Mr. Chair, if I may, Representative Schumacher, is there anybody that is opposed to this?
Representative Liebling, from the time that the bill has been introduced and posted, I have not interacted with anyone who has any opposition to the bill.
There is a 10-page packet inside of your with the bill that you've been given. They did want to testify, but they weren't able to make it this morning. So I'd encourage members to take a look at that. Hopefully it's there. Mr. Kyrie, do you want to explain that, why it's not there?
It should be in 3573. I'm looking at the insurance.
Okay.
We'll take a moment for members to check that out if they want. Representative Branson.
Well, I see. Is it from child care providers? Okay, so members, we're going to be hearing a bill. No? Okay, so we've got the same issue with child care providers, that they've been wrapped up with this fingerprinting at the age of 13 to 17. So all across the state, when I've done my traveling, that's probably one of the many concerns that the providers have, is that the fact that their children are being fingerprinted. And I know foster parents have come to me with the same concerns. So I would suggest that we support Representative Schumacher's bill. And in that packet, yes, indeed, there is some testifiers. You may see some testimony from child care providers on the fingerprint, but that does extend to those that are doing foster care as well.
Any other questions, members? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Franson, for that explanation. Has DHS expressed an opinion on this bill?
Chair Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Liebling, they have not with me expressed any opinion.
Representative Liebling.
Well, okay. I guess I don't have any other questions on it. I feel like there are more ins and outs to this than we're really discussing here today, and I'm a little bit uncomfortable because we're not sort of getting the full thinking behind it. I mean, I'd sort of like to understand why they're doing it in the first place and, you know, what the impact might be. You know, I understand, you know, this is sort of a difficult topic. I mean, I'm more familiar with it just from the discussion in the child care area that Representative Franson was talking about, but, you know, it's trying to strike the right balance between not making people feel like criminals who aren't and, you know, are having their privacy invaded in some respect, and also the potential safety impact that I assume is the reason for doing this in the first place. So I just feel like we're not having a full discussion of it here, and I'm not very comfortable making the change. I mean, I'm not saying I'm opposed to it. I just feel like I don't have enough information to make a good decision here today.
Representative Sandsteed.
Sandsteed. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay. This is just a clarification to a statement that Rep. Franson just made in regards to the documents we have on the child care workers and the fingerprinting concerns that they have. You said it extends to the foster care workers as well. Do you have any, have you had a conversation with foster care workers, or do you have documentation of any of that?
Representative Liebling or Franson?
Thank you. No, I didn't realize that we were going to have to document personal conversations that we had with people. Mr. Chair, thank you. I just am curious, just for support of this, because this bill is specifically for foster care workers rather than child care. I'm not disagreeing about the child care issue, but we do have a 10-page document supporting their concerns in the realm of child care. I'm just wondering if we have anything in support of foster care workers.
Representative Branson.
Well, that's Representative Sandsteed. That's why I had mentioned the fact that this dealt with child care providers, in case some of you over there were confused on why I didn't say foster care. Thank you. And just one more question for the author. Could you clarify again, Chair Schumacher, who brought this bill forward? Is this a bill of your own, or did a constituent, or did somebody come to you and ask you to carry this forward?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Sandsteed. This bill was brought forward to me from the foster care organizations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Precia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, just by way of background, at least on the child care side, this came through Representative Franson's committee last year, and we talked about this. Some of the rules that changed on this, as I understand them, were some overzealous interpretations of federal push down to state. And there was some, we had long conversations with people at DHS. There were some individuals that interpreted some federal rules, like I said, over broadly. Members, I would speak in high support of this bill, because the foster care problem that we have now is we don't have enough of them. And this is what's stopping us from getting more. It's parents that are getting worried about, do I have to fingerprint all of my kids just to take care of the kids in my community? So I would caution us not to make more out of this than it is. We already do extensive background checks on many of the other kids that are in there. And I'm just going to speak strongly in support of this. We're going to have less foster care parents and families if we continue to put them through the rigmaroles of the judicial system like this and treat them like criminals when they're just trying to help.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, I have a bill out there that has to do with some of the issues that foster parents are having. And through those discussions and the fact that I'm also on the subcommittee on child care and have talked with many child care providers, parents tend to be protective and worry about their children. And there are concerns, and as was mentioned by Representative Precia, we have a shortage. You know, we don't have enough foster care families. We don't have enough daycare families. And
if you listen to them, and it's common, they feel some of this is onerous, especially since the federal requirements do not require minors to be fingerprinted. The state is the one that says, oh, we're going to extend it to the minors. And I think that's what is meant by these bills coming forward. And I can say that I have talked with foster families that have this concern. And I treat those conversations confidential unless they say, do so. Then I say, write a letter, and we'll have it entered in as testimony.
Any other questions, members? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder if DHS, somebody's in the room that could come down and speak to this a little bit, because, I represent Krish. I hear you on the problem about needing more foster families, but, I also sometimes hear from foster families or from kids who've grown up in foster care who've had suffered abuse in foster care. I mean, that does happen, too, and I don't know if fingerprinting minors in foster care helps that or not, but I'd like to understand a little more, if this is just an overreach and a misinterpretation of requirements, or if there's something real, some concern behind the fact this is being done before we just remove it.
The department evidently has come down. Please introduce yourself and give your testimony.
Mr. Chair, Patrick Carter from the Department of Human Services. Sorry, Representative Liebling, I was walking down. What was your question?
Well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for coming down. I just would like to hear the department's take on the bill. If you could just give us a little background about why we're doing this fingerprinting. Have there been incidents where we've, uncovered anything that's been, does the department have a safety concern if we were to remove this requirement? Can you just kind of give us the landscape of what of this bill, what's going on here?
Mr. Carter?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the change that is being proposed here would be undoing a requirement that passed in law in 2014, where the background studies conducted by the Department of Human Services were converted from a name and date of birth check to fingerprint-based studies. For child foster care studies, those checks were onboarded into the system starting in 2016 into 2017. By converting studies from name and date of birth checks from fingerprint checks to name and date of birth checks, at the state level, at least, they searched the same databases at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. However, there is the potential loss of one piece of information by switching from fingerprint-based studies to name and date of birth studies.
Well, the other way, I think, right?
Yes, thank you. From fingerprint to name and date of birth. And that is what's called an offender status. It's information we at DHS received from the BCA that if an individual has a criminal record in Minnesota, it indicates that there could potentially be a record in another state. So by making that transition from fingerprint to name and date of birth, the BCA would no longer give us that indication. However, there could be potential remedies to kind of backfill that loss of information with some additional changes to this bill.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that explanation. So if this bill were to become law, the department could and still would do a background check on the minors who are in foster homes. They just wouldn't do it through fingerprinting. Is that what I'm understanding? And I remember when we went to that fingerprint system, and it was pretty controversial because it wasn't just for this. It was for, everybody who's getting a background study in the DHS system. And it is intrusive, and there were some problems that sort of because of we had to do it for certain reasons, that we couldn't get information that we needed otherwise, as you're explaining. But so if we were to remove this for these younger kids, would the department still be doing a background study on them then, just with name and date of birth, just to,
know that they don't have a in-state criminal record? Is that kind of what you're explaining here?
Mr. Carter?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct. If this bill were to be implemented, there would still be a study on minor household members in child foster care homes. However, it would use name and date of birth information instead of fingerprints.
Representative Weaven?
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. That's comforting, actually. I mean, it is, you know, I don't even know if that name and date of birth study is, you know, how important that is, but at least it's not going from something to nothing. So that makes me feel a lot more comfortable with the bill. Thank you.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just so we can better understand what we're doing here, and not that we are confused to anything, we just want to be more informed. And so I'm just wondering, and I understand that there is a shortage of foster parents right now, and it's really complicated for them now, and, you know, we need to do better in a lot of areas around within that department. But I'm wondering, for like kinship families, do they have to also do a background check for youth in their homes?
Mr. Carter?
Mr. Chair, Representative Moran, I don't have that information in front of me, but we'd be glad to follow up with kind of the background set of requirements across child foster care, kinship, and adoption assistance programs. There's varying requirements across all three of those, and I'd be glad to follow up.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Moran.
I think that would be helpful because we also have a shortage of kids going into kinship care because of the many barriers that are in place for them also. And we do need to recognize that we can't make assumptions that because someone is taking on the job of being a foster parent, that everyone in the household is clear and upstanding or do not have a background as a youth. So I think it's really important that when we're looking at kids that we're pulling out of homes and we say that the first priority is their well-being, that we're not doing due diligence to make sure the home that they're going into is a safe environment also. So, you know, as much as we have a shortage of foster care parents, that should not be our priority because it's not about the home, it's about the child. We want to make sure that child is safe. So for that reason, I cannot support this bill. And I would like to have more information on kinship care and what are what type of background information is needed in those households.
Mr. Carter, any comments?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we'd be glad to follow up with that information.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a few years ago when I and my wife provided kinship care, they did not require the same, you know, you were exempted from the normal foster care background review or, you know, are your windows this size, et cetera. And this bill doesn't touch on or affect one iota of what you're asking about because, you know, we aren't, it just is not relational. And if you want to generate a bill that would make kinship care just as difficult as foster care because it's family members, then you're welcome to. But don't burden this bill, which is trying to do something for a reason that's, you know, totally outside it. And let's stick to the bill.
Representative Moran.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Kwan, can you define what is one iota? What does that mean? Because I believe that this is not about kinship care. It is about the foster care and then them being exempt. That is my comment. I'm not trying to burden anyone, but it just is about the well-being of the child. And I hope that you can see that, and that when kids are being pulled out of their homes and who are traumatized and they're going to a foster care home setting, that's important, too, that we are ensuring that they're going to be safe. And so that's my comment about this. I'm not trying to railroad this bill, but my concern is about the child.
Members, this bill does have another stop, so if there's some disagreement with, we're just about out of time, so if there's some disagreement, you might want to take it offline afterwards. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think that, unfortunately, Representative Schumacher, I think your bill is a kind of seeing some concerns just for lack of information. I think that this is a really important thing to talk about, but I think that a lot of us need a lot more information before we can make this decision. I'm curious, for example, if these fingerprint studies versus the name and dates, birth date studies, can dig further into criminal backgrounds of youth who are who get into the criminal justice system, because we do treat their information differently than we do an adult who gets into the criminal justice system. That becomes public information. We don't treat youth data the same way. And so I don't know if that's one of the reasons that this was put into place. And maybe we don't even need to find out about it now. But if we hear, you know, when we hear this bill again, I would really suggest that we get some good information about why this was put into place in the first place, and what information we might lose out on if we change this, because we do have to ensure that the children that are being placed in foster care are being placed into a safe place. If we can get there with name and date of birth, then that's fine. But I think that based on what we've heard today, we don't know that for sure. And so knowing that for sure would be really helpful.
Mr. Carter, any comments?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we'd be glad to follow up on kind of the juvenile justice record piece of that for you.
Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just very quickly, and I wasn't going to speak again, but members, I want to caution us. I hear what we're talking about. And we've talked, folks on the other side, that we've talked about these issues, but be very wary of what you're about to do if you argue against this. We have a huge problem with minorities and disparities getting into this system. And you are about to ask, if we were to stop this, you're about to ask minority and disparity families to have one more stronger interaction with law enforcement that they don't need. And I think we have to be very careful. We want to be opening and becoming to allow more families to be more representative. We need more foster cares of like kids, not less. I understand our concerns of security and all that. Fingerprinting is not going to prevent that. Fingerprinting is not going to talk about the intent of a kid or the intent of a family. There's way other mechanisms and backgrounds to do that. So I understand what we're doing, and I know why we're doing, and I know the questions we're having on a good intention. I'm just saying I think we're putting up some barriers and we're adding some layers that I keep hearing over and over in the child protection of why we have the difficult interactions we have with families and disparities and racial disparities. So I just have to throw that up as a caution.
Last question, Representative Helverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and sorry I have to respond to that because I think that Representative Crescia, you have mischaracterized the discussion. I think that what has happened is that there's been a lot of questions raised that you and others can say what you believe and what you think and even maybe what you know, but we don't have the studies, we don't have the data, we don't have testimony about if we get to the questions that we're trying to answer with regard to security without the fingerprints. And as I said and others have said, maybe we do. It's just that we don't have that information to make that decision. If we can get that information to make that decision, I think that everybody would feel better. But for anybody who is going to take a vote on the safety and security of children in the foster care system, we want to be sure that we're taking a vote that someday isn't going to lead to a tragedy. And so it's simply more information that people are asking for. I don't think saying that we are going to vote against a bill because this is a bad idea or because we don't care about expanding the foster care system is a fair characterization.
Representative Crescia, your name was mentioned.
Thank you, Briefly. Mr. Chair. That was never my characterization. I have not impugned anybody's intent. I've just said what I think is setting up barriers. And I've heard much testimony on this. I'm not speaking from a point of ignorance on this. That's how I bring it up.
With that, members, you know, if you have additional questions or comments, I'm sure Chair Schumacher is open to talking with you about that. Any final comments, Chair Schumacher?
No, I understand how people are going to have to vote on this one, and apologize for not being better prepared for the committee on this bill. And ask for your support, but understand if you can't.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. With that, Chair Schumacher renews his motion that HF 3169 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices. Those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign.
No.
The motion prevails. HF 3169 is re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices. With that, members, we will recess until the call of the chair at approximately 5:30. Please watch your email.
Then I think you're falling way short of what American citizens and Minnesota citizens are demanding today. So I'm asking that anybody that has recognized that, yeah, mandating continuing education courses for 2 hours a year, 2 hours or whatever this is, and if they aren't getting it, then that's a problem, because we're here because of the bad players in your system. And most of the medical community has really stepped up. The medical providers, I will say 90% of them have embraced this, and they would probably have no problem with this. But because of your association's typical mandating practice thing, you have to sort of say no. But on this one, I want to make sure you take a deep breath. When we hear this again, I really do hope that the MMA will relook at this, as I've been asking the drug manufacturers that have made so much money on this thing that they would reconsider coming to the table and giving us something. Chair Dean has mentioned the carbon bags. How easy would it be for them to come forward with a whole bunch of those things, support a local Minnesota company, and make sure that everybody who drives through a pharmacist would get a carbon bag to make sure there's not one single pill a pharmaceutical heroin left in that medicine cabinet at the end of the day. They can do that, but they're choosing not to. So, sorry to go off a little bit here tonight, Mr. Chair, but Mr. Dick is a friend, and I respect what you're doing, but I want everybody who's going to sit here and oppose an opioid reasonable bill better be ready, because I am looking at different ways that we have to do this now. The drug manufacturing companies, especially one or two early on, We're educating doctors 25 years ago. Now we have to uneducate these doctors. And again, most of them have found the reason to get it, but there's still a few out there that are bad players, that are overprescribing, they don't listen, and this bill is the right thing to do for now. And I think that actually doing a sunset, Representative Dean, is not a bad idea, because again, this is a very fluid situation. I want to really believe someday we're going to get this thing under control. And if we get there, then we're all a part of this. But to the people that want to stand up and always oppose everything or oppose things because that's what we've always done, it's not the right time to do this when we're talking about opioids. Appreciate that. Thanks.
Any other questions for the testifier? Seeing none, Mr. Dick, the committee thanks you. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 3023? Seeing none, Representative Freiberg, I understand you have a couple of amendments. Which do you wish to take up first?
The A1 amendment.
Representative Freiberg moves the A1 amendment. Representative Freiberg, to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Dean, for authoring this bill. I think it's a good bill. One thing Mr. Dick said when he testified was that he doesn't think. I'm sympathetic to what he said. I'm hesitant to go into telling medical professions what they should do. However, I don't think your bill does that. It's not a one-size-fits-all approach. It talks about just best practices for prescribing opioids. And I think given what Representative Baker talked about, and he can speak about it with much more knowledge and understandable passion than I can, but I think just given the magnitude of the problem, I think it is something we need to tackle. I think your bill is not a one-size-fits-all approach. It just talks about best practices. So, you know, I have an amendment here that would add on to it 2 hours of continuing education on non-pharmacological alternatives for the treatment of pain and ongoing pain management per credit cycle, which, you know, in the case of the Board of Medical Practice is 75 hours in a 3-year cycle, which I don't think 2 hours within that is out of line, particularly given the magnitude of the problem. I have a publication here. I'm sorry to not make copies, but it's just a fact sheet from the CDC talking about the guidelines for prescribing opioids for chronic pain. And the first thing it says here is non-pharmacologic therapy and non-opioid pharmacologic therapy are preferred for chronic pain. And, you know, that can take many forms. So, you know, I would say, you know, that whether you're talking about physical therapy, chiropractic, occupational therapy, massage therapy, acupuncture, there's lots of things that could fall under that umbrella term. So I would say this amendment still leaves plenty of discretion within the Board of Medical Practice and within doctors to choose it. It's not a one-size-fits-all approach. I see it as a small step that I'm certainly hopeful will help reduce what is a problem of extraordinary magnitude in our society right now. Chair Dean, you mentioned you're willing to look at a sunset. I'd certainly be willing to. I don't think that's a bad idea for this amendment either. If you are modifying this as it goes forward, I hope members would look favorably upon this amendment and look forward to discussion.
Chair Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Freiberg, and thank you for stopping by my office to discuss these amendments with me. I appreciate that. The scope of what we're trying to do within the bill really looks at the dangers of opioids and what can happen if you prescribe opioids versus not, but also which kinds of opiates are best associated with which kind with what kind of surgery or rehabilitation, and then not in many cases when they're not indicated. That's the gist of it, is to try to really get at that, so that, for example, that it might be that a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory is preferable to an opiate, or it might be that an opiate would be Tylenol with codeine would be preferable to oxycodone as a prescribed agent for recovery because of the relative differences in how addictive that they can be. So those are the kinds of things that that this bill is really aimed at. We do have lots of other things that come before this committee on alternative therapies, whether they be acupuncture or marijuana or other things. And that's really not where this bill is aimed at. This is really aimed at why people are dying, how they get addicted, and how we can get that better controlled at the prescription end. So that's why I would oppose the amendment, both amendments, just because they kind of take the focus away from that very narrow focus that I would like this to have.
Questions on the A1 amendment? Is there anyone who wishes to testify on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
Aye.
No.
Aye.
The motion does not prevail. Representative Freiberg.
That's okay. I don't need to offer the other one.
Representative Freiberg does not offer the A2 amendment. Back to the House File 3023. Are there any final questions for Representative Dean?
Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to kind of confirm with Representative Dean. You talked about putting a sunset on it. So if this passes here today, is it kind of with the intention that you would do that? And what would the sunset be? What's your thinking about how long you'd have this thing last?
Chair Dean.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, what I'm trying to find out is with the different boards, how often they – if you're licensed, how often you have to go to get relicensed, and to just extend it out so that if you're out there today and you're prescribing, that you see that in the next, let's say we just said for 2018 or 19 and you're not up until 20, so that we kind of catch this crop of folks. Currently, we kick it out. I don't know if that's 3 years, 22, I don't know what, 21, whatever that would be. So that's kind of what I'm trying to figure out right now.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one other thing, Representative Dean, I didn't really hear anything about whether other states have done this, whether, just kind of responding to Representative Baker, I think it's really important that we try our best to get our arms around this, but not everything that sounds good is going to be effective. That's kind of what I wrestle with. And so I think, if we knew that something was going to help, then I think all of us are more willing to be more intrusive and say, let's push people and because we know it's going to help. We had a great example of this some years ago when we put the Sudafed behind the counter, and it had an immediate effect. There was a lot of pushback to us doing that, but it worked, at least for a number of years it worked. Apparently there's a new way that's all coming back. But, so if there's some evidence that this is going to make a difference beyond what Mr. Dick was talking about, I think he was talking about the fact that they're already doing a lot of this, and yet here we are passing a bill kind of, maybe we're getting some people who aren't already in that process, but I don't know from the discussion today. So do you have anything to say that, they did this in Iowa and it made a difference or anything like that?
Sure, Dean.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, there's in my district, there's lots of folks who are licensed both in Minnesota and Wisconsin. And in Wisconsin, they do, in fact, have a two-hour mandate. And directly, some of the feedback I got was that, we probably should be doing that. And to Representative Baker's point about people who are maybe trained in the 80s have a little different point of view on opioids, that they're probably the ones that may not be looking to break new ground with their CME credits, and maybe they should be the ones that we really need to be talking to, the ones that might be more prone to skipping it. So that's the only relevant example with direct people that I've spoken with.
Thank you.
But the NCSL does have this as one of the one of the things that we did look at a conference last summer, and it was proposed and I believe adopted in some states.
Any other final questions for Chair Dean? Seeing none, final word.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and members. And just as we look at these opioid bills that are going to be coming through, just think about them as a continuum. And as the furthest continuum down is Narcan. And that's after somebody has already OD'd, we can try to bring them back. And then if you think further upstream about trying to pull pills out of people's cabinets that have already been put out there, then if you think a little further up about limiting the supply, then if you think further up about limiting the kinds of opioids, then think a little bit further up about should we be prescribing opioids at all. This is the furthest upstream in I think that we can do, and that's why that I chose to start out with this bill on this important topic this year. So I respectfully ask your support for the bill, and thanks for work on all of the opioid bills this year.
With that, Representative Dean renews his motion that House File 3023 be referred to the Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 3023 is pre-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. Next up, Chair Dean has House File 3139. After that, we'll have Representative Quam's 2780 and Representative Baker's 3605. Representative Dean moves that House File 3139 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Representative Dean, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. House File 3139 takes up where another bill left off. We introduced this bill last year with the Prescribed Pediatric Extended Care Centers, or PPECs, and this is think about it as a licensed care, like a daycare facility for kids with complex needs, for children that currently have, are medically complex. If you can imagine being a mom or a dad, you don't have very many options during the day, whether the kid is coming home from the hospital or recent diagnosis. You really have very few options, so they're in the hospital, which is very, very expensive, or mom and dad can't go to work. So What this does is we introduced the bill. We've sort of been chewing on it between the agency and stakeholders saying this is brand new. We really don't know how this works yet. How do you pay for it? We have Six. We had several trials that we were saying, let's try it out here in the community. We'll tow it on a trial basis. So now we say we got to move it down. Let's just try it at two, and let's look at how we pay for this. So we've got Susan Wingertz here from Pediatric Home Services to kind of describe the bill in detail and answer any questions that folks have about this. Again, this is brand new. So this isn't something that has been licensed here before. So we're breaking new ground, and it's a really exciting opportunity, I think, for families with children with complex medical needs.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Wingertz. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
My name is Susan Wingertz. I own a small company called Pediatric Home Service. I would first like to thank you all for passing the bill last year. It is an extremely important step, and now I'd like to ask for support for 3139 to continue that process. As Chair Dean has mentioned, the PPEC, Prescribed Pediatric Extended Care, is an alternative that might allow us to bring children out of the largest institution that we have, and that is the hospital. Right now, there are children that are languishing in the hospital, ready to come home, but without appropriate caregivers to take care of them in their home. There is a shortage. I know I'm singing to the choir here. There is a shortage of all healthcare professionals and direct care providers. What we are looking at doing is taking a situation where the child will stay in the hospital. Yes, it's expensive to the state, but more importantly, it does not integrate that child into the community, back to their family with their moms, their dads, their sisters, their brothers, their pets. This will allow us to take more children out, free up some of the resources that are very scarce to take care of those children that can't be cared for in an environment that has more than one child. It's a new concept. We would very much like your support. And we're working diligently with the departments to make sure that we can handle this and pay for this in an appropriate way. I'm open to any questions that you might have.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Wingert. Are there any questions for the testifier? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Wingert. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
I'm reading your little handout here, and it talks about the 14 hours a day. So are these children that need additional support at home during the hours then when they would go home?
Ms. Wingert.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, I want you to understand, because we've not done this before, everything I'm saying here is my speculation versus my knowledge base. What we believe is going to happen is that the children that are more stable in their home care environment, those that have been home maybe for 6, 8, 10, 12 months, maybe more, would be coming into the daycare center. And those children will have had the opportunity to have their parents educated, support systems educated, and they'll probably, although I want to be clear, I can't say exclusively, will need no further help in their home. If they do, that is a different, that would be a one-to-one home care, and there is nothing in the bill that precludes that from continuing to happen.
Okay.
Representative Liebling.
That's all, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Are there any other questions for Ms. Wingert? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony this evening. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 3139? If you could please make your way forward. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jean Bender. I want to caution those who know me from my volunteer work that I'm here today testifying on behalf of myself and my family and not for any organizations for which I volunteer. I urge you to proceed with caution considering House File 3139. 45 years ago, I was in elementary school in St. Peter, in the same school that shared space with children who lived at the St. Peter State Hospital. Those children
were not a part of our school. Rather, they used the hallways at different times than other students. Their lunch period was separate. Their recess was separate. Everything was separate. If our paths crossed, teachers would hustle us out of the halls and into our classrooms. I feared those kids because of the adult reactions to them. Then later, when I was in high school, a classmate experienced a traumatic brain injury and moved from her home and started living in a nursing home. My personal experience is that all of the others and those who need complex support, levels of support, are placed somewhere else. Fast forward 20 years. I have a son with multiple disabilities. When we were raising him and times were tough, either medically or behaviorally for him, my own mother said, "It's too bad the state hospital is closed to kids like him." A state hospital is not a place for kids to be. And I caution that placement in any separate segregated center that isolates them from families and peers who become visitors in children's lives rather than family members and classmates is something we need to consider very carefully. The problem with expanding center-based programs for kids and families in crisis, medical or otherwise, is that it isolates them from the community. Their crises stay their crises. People and informal support networks can say, "Isn't there a place for that?" instead of, "How can I help?" And then people start competing for beds, and temporary stays get extended. Fast forward again. My son, who has diagnoses of Down syndrome, epilepsy, autism, vision impairment, hearing impairment, and a spinal cord injury affecting everything from the neck down, is a kid who requires complex care. This past year, he spent 60 days in the hospital, and I spent all but two overnights with him, and his dad stayed those two nights. One of us was present 24 hours of every one of those 60 days. And he's home now, and he lives with us in a duplex. Half is his home, half is ours. And when he doesn't have staff, one of us is home with him, and we're working on building the support system he'll need when we're gone. I understand the situation and the very good intentions of Pediatric Home Services and Chair Dean. Are there problems for families who desperately need support to raise and care for their children? Yes. Are there workforce shortages causing crisis? Absolutely. But is this the answer? I'm not sure. We have to fix the disparities that pay institutional care workers more than home care workers. We need to support families who need in-home services for their children rather than over-monitoring budgets for potential fraud that isn't there and creating layers of paperwork to approve every little expenditure. Give families access to the $500 per day that this bill proposes rather than tying the funding to a specific placement. I urge you to be cautious in funding a Band-Aid while ignoring the broader issues. We don't want places for them and those kids. Children deserve to be in their homes, not places in care residences or anywhere else. I don't want the answer for families who desperately need services to be send them there. Because if there are beds to fill, they will be filled, and the children will be someone else's problem. Our history has taught us that. Thank you for listening. I want to add that I have spoken with Pediatric Home Services, and I'm certainly willing to meet with them to discuss some of my concerns further. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bender, for your testimony. Are there any questions for the testifier? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify in House File 3139? Seeing none, final questions from members. Final word, Representative Dean.
I'd just like to thank Ms. Bender for coming in. I agree with many of her concerns, and I think our committee probably shares many of them, and we will certainly take those into consideration as we move forward with the bill.
This is not a residential facility.
Yeah. Ms. Wingard reminds me this is not a residential facility, and that certainly is not taking the place of a home, but it is simply providing another opportunity for care for kids with complex needs. But I do appreciate the testimony and look forward to support. Thank you, members.
With that, Representative Dean renews his motion that House File 3139 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 3139 is re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Thank you, Chair Dean. Next up, House File 2780, Representative Quam, followed by Representative Baker's 3605 and Representative Albright's series of bills. Representative Quam moves that his bill, that House File 2780, be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Representative Quam, we have the bill in front of us. Do your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. There is an amendment A2.
Representative Quam moves the A2 amendment. Representative Quam, to your bill, to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. If you looked at the A2 and compared it to the existing bill language, Section 1 is very similar, but it's slightly improved and I think a little better layout and putting in verbiage. The rest are some clarifications. In the child care subcommittee, there was an informational amendment that didn't make it in time to be included, which had some concerns from child care providers about notification, getting rid of the photographs, etc. And I discussed with the department. They looked at it, came up with some language, and we've got A2, which is sort of a combination of the different stakeholders. And so A2 is meant to improve communication and clarity and also add some comfort to, clearing up where things were missing as to exactly what happened with the pictures and et cetera. So I would hope you could support the combined work between providers and the department.
Are there any questions on the A2 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the A2 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A2 amendment is adopted. Representative Quam, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The first section, I've been attending meetings between the department and daycare providers over several years and most recently some meetings before session. And the first section, we're bifurcating the background studies, and people came forward and said, I've got a 17-year-old or I've got a junior or senior in high school, and I don't want to pay for a background study and then turn around and do it again. I said, well, I will put in language that would allow the option. This is no requirement, but it would allow an option in certain cases where they decided that they wanted to opt for the full 5-year background check. And that's just the reason for section number one. The rest of the bill is mainly to improve notification, clarify what is not being retained, when things are being destroyed. You've got third parties that are collecting some fingerprints and other data and what they're allowed to retain and what's needed for record keeping. And then the final section is it became clear that there are a multitude of different background studies that DHS and other departments have, and daycare children are not the only vulnerable people that we are monitoring, doing background checks, and to see if there's a way that we can be more consistent. And in doing so, we can prevent, someone that is subbing for vacation, which is pretty common, they might be working in 5 different counties. They don't want to pay for 5 different background studies. And so looking at the capability that at the statewide, the counties could call and check, and they'd be able to find out, yes, this person has passed a valid background check, and it's good through these dates, and you wouldn't have to incur the additional cost. So it's getting rid of some duplicative activity. And I'm available for specific questions.
All right, Representative Quam, I understand you have a testifier.
I believe there are a couple people that are available here that might wish to testify.
All right. If you could please make your way forward. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Chairman and committee members, thank you for taking the time this evening to hear my testimony. My name is Julie Seidel, and I am the Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Association of Child Care Professionals, and I've also been a licensed child care provider for 15 years. There are provisions in Senator Quam's bill that we are in agreement with, but there will be need to be some clarification so that family child care providers have the ability to make an informed decision when choosing to voluntarily put their minor children into the FBI's NGI database. We are requesting that the privacy notice to the background study subject be given prior to the provider and her child going down to be fingerprinted. Also, the language that has been stricken stating that the fingerprints will be retained by the FBI is extremely misleading to providers. We know for a fact that the FBI will have to retain the fingerprints in order to check them for what they call future criminal activity, which was stated by DHS. We are also requesting a provision giving providers the ability to request the BCA remove our data from the FBI database if we have chosen to continue doing child care. We should not have to wait for DHS to decide to remove that data in 2 years. And by FBI rules, the BCA would have to request that for us. We could not have DHS request it. We would have to go directly to the BCA, and we would like that option because currently they will keep our information until we're 110 years old or have been dead for 7 years, and I think that's a little bit ridiculous. So thank you for hearing my testimony.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Seidel. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I've had discussions on this topic and issue. There's some looking at amendment language. But because the next stop is civil law, the purview of that committee fits this type of discussion and work. And so the decision was to, you know, have an amendment in that discussion in that committee.
All right. Are there any questions for the testifier? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony this evening. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 2780? Seeing none, final questions from members. Final word, Representative Quam.
I wish to renew my motion.
With that, Representative Quam renews his motion that House File 2780, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices Policy. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 2780, as amended, is re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Data Practices Policy. Thank you, Representative Quam. Up next, Representative Baker with House File 3605, followed by the remainder of the Albright bills. Representative Baker moves that House File 3605 be re-referred to the Committee on Job Growth and Energy Affordability. We have the bill in front of us. Representative Baker, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And thank you for moving up our testimony. We have a testifier from Wilmer, so we appreciate getting her on the road again today. This was a bill, members, that I've carried since I arrived here 2-3 years ago, and it has been a very popular grant program with child care expansions and retaining slots. Child care centers don't happen to get on their own and create themselves, and especially in rural areas. The partnerships among providers and businesses and nonprofits can offer creative solutions, and the demand for this funding is at an all-time high. For the 2016 appropriation, 15 proposals were submitted to DEED with a total of $1.3 million requested. The last couple of times we've carried this bill, we allocated $500,000 for matching grants for in-home daycares or daycares to make sure that we're keeping the slots available for kids so we don't lose any more than we have to. With this current model that we've had in the last couple of years, we have saved over 300 children care slots. And with this legislation and the last few, this will actually help us retain 972 slots for kids in child care. So folks like me
if their moms or dads want to come out and work, I can get them to work, but we need places for them, for the kids to go that are safe. So this has been a very popular grant program, and with you, Mr. Chair, is a person who wants to testify from my hometown. So here's me.
All right. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Mary Lockhart Findling. I am the Head Start Director of United Community Action Partnership. We serve much of central and southwest Minnesota, including the counties of Candiohye County in Willmar. We also serve Cottonwood, Jackson, McLeod, Meeker, Lincoln, Lyon, Redwood, and Renville counties. So we are a pretty big rural program. In speaking for Minnesota Head Start Association and my local Minnesota Community Action Program and my Head Start program in particular, we support House File 3605 to build child care infrastructure and the early learning workforce in Minnesota. In my program, we struggle to find buildings and classrooms that can be licensed and are suitable for early childhood facilities and that are able to create the indoor and outdoor environments for quality programs so that young children under the age of five can thrive. Infant toddler space is particularly critical for our communities in rural Minnesota. United Community Action Partnership currently has a wait list of 137 early Head Start children, and of those, we serve 119 early Head Start slots, but only 8 of them are in center-based care, and that is strictly due to the lack of facilities that we have. In our toddler room, which we only are able to serve 8 because of lack of facilities, we have a wait list of 41 children for those 8 slots currently, and that's located in Willmar. Also, we are constantly not knowing from year to year where our classrooms can be located due to facility needs. In Willmar, in the last 2 years, we've had to move 3 classrooms. In Marshall, we're currently losing classroom space for 5 classrooms. So we have to relocate our classrooms from year to year simply because we lose the space that we're leasing from because they may be needed for other programs, for school districts, churches, wherever we can find a space that's licensable. The child care shortage and qualified staffing shortage in Minnesota has called on all of us to partner and blend our services together. We can't do it alone in order to provide high quality, full year, full day care for our young children. As Senator Baker said, child care centers don't happen on their own in rural Minnesota, but with partnerships in businesses and CAP agencies and local governments that can offer solutions. While the appropriation of $519,000 won't meet all of our needs, it certainly is a critical step in the right direction in maintaining those funds. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Lockhart-Milling. Are there any questions for the testifier? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for being here to testify and coming all that way and staying around. So I know that the shortage of child care is really a critical issue, and it's hurting not only families but employers, and it really is a problem. And first of all, I know you mentioned that the $519,000 isn't a lot, and my response to that is it sure isn't. And that's the amount for the whole state, right? Not just your area. And even though the bill says that 60% has to go to communities outside the 7-county metro. So I'm assuming that if we've got several grants, it's not going to be a lot of money per. But I wonder if you could just give me an example, if you have some thoughts about how you might use the money, because there's in the bill it has sort of several suggestions about how the money might be used to. And do you have some experience with what would be the most effective way to jumpstart some additional capacity? Are you thinking about just building more space or, you know, renting some additional space? Or just give us a little flavor of what you would think of doing with this additional money.
Ms. Lockhart, feeling.
As the Head Start program, we certainly can't do it on our own. And in that amount of funding, we certainly can't do it on our own. But we do have to rely on partnerships, partnerships with private child care programs, partnerships with the faith community, partnerships with city councils, and partnerships with local government. That's the only way that we can be able to create. And we do. We're at a point where we need to create more stabilized facilities for child care. We can't go from year to year leasing and being removed because a school or a church or another facility needs their space back. So we do need to create facilities. I don't have the answers, but I certainly am will be active in my own communities where we do our Head Start services to find and procure those partnerships.
Representative Liebling.
Okay, thank you. I see another testifier came to the table and maybe would like to address this. I just was kind of curious to Representative Baker about the very specific amount of money that's in the bill and where that number came from.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, I think that was a number that we've used every year. It should be bigger. I think we're just trying to slice up how much we can get out for these type of matching grants. $500,000 is what's worked out, well, not enough in the last couple of years. I think it's just finding the resources. But it was a number that came through the Jobs and Energy Committee, which I serve on. And this is the first time we've kind of presented this bill, at least to this committee. I'm going to keep pushing for more funding in the future because it's such a dire need, again, especially in rural Minnesota. So I think the next testifier might be able to answer your question a little bit better, too.
Follow-up, Representative Liebling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Any other questions for Ms. Lockhart-Filling? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony today.
Thank you.
Ms. Stout, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Hi, I'm Stacey Stout with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Chair Schumacher and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today in support of House File 3605. The Minnesota Chamber represents over 2,300 businesses, mostly small and medium-sized businesses, and the number one concern we hear across the state is the workforce shortage. The current need for workers is compounded by the child care shortage across our state and in the communities. And this acute shortage of affordable child care facilities, particularly in greater Minnesota, impacts employment opportunities for those families, for people with young children. And it as Representative Baker alluded to, it affects the employers because then they're not able to fill the open jobs that we have. I think everyone on this committee is hearing when they go back home the workforce shortage and the child care shortage. So we know that it's important to increase the number of child care shortage or child care facilities. We need to make sure that they're quality care providers, and by supporting this bill, we can support targeted resources in early childhood care aligned with quality ratings and fostering private sector investment. I wanted to briefly address Representative Liebling's questions. I'm not sure how the original amount started whenever the first language was written, but in the last year when the grants were when there were grants that were being sought after, the total was $1.3 million. And so $500,000 was awarded out of that. So it seemed to make sense to put another $500,000 this year because we know there's a little more than that were just in the most recent request. And the other piece I wanted to touch on was in the deed Greater Minnesota Child Care Grants report, they stated that the funding is used for, not limited to, but funding for child care business startup or expansion, training, facility modifications or improvements required for licensing, and assistance with licensing and other regulatory requirements. So the funding can be used in however the community really needs it. And therefore, we think this is a really good bill. It will help the communities with the documented shortage of child care, and it
it's important to keep our workforce challenges from hampering economic growth. So I appreciate your time, and I hope that you'll support this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Stout, for your testimony. Are there any questions for the testifier? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 3605? Seeing none, are there any other questions? Oh, yeah. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Dorman. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. My name is Dan Dorman. I represent the Greater Minnesota Partnership and also speaking on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. The partnership that I represent has about 100 members throughout Greater Minnesota, businesses, chambers of commerce, nonprofits, et cetera, that have come together to try to advocate for economic development policy and, of course, dollars that will benefit the economies of Greater Minnesota. Child care is a new issue for us, and so we're learning. We're trying not to step on any toes as we plod along and learn a lot, but what we found, we did some polling of our members after the last session, top three issues, no shock to anyone here, trained workforce, workforce housing, and child care. And really, they're all three linked directly to economic development, because if a community is lacking in one of those three, they're going to have problems creating jobs, retaining employees. It will just continue to be a problem. And so our members are very interested in this. Interesting enough, when we look to our members, we, you know, do a phone call, and put together a conference call and ask our members to comment on something or get ideas from them. Generally, we have 10, 12, maybe sometimes 14 people on the line. When we did this, we opened it up to our members of both organizations. We ended up with almost 80 people on the phone. It just sort of speaks to the demand, the need, and how businesses and communities are responding to it in Greater Minnesota. Like other testifiers commented, we certainly wish the dollar amount was bigger, but we also understand the limitations of the budget, and we're certainly hopeful that you will find this a worthy bill to support. With that, I will cease my testimony, because I know you've got a long agenda, but would be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions for Mr. Dorman? Representative Allen.
All right, I can wait until the testifier is not. It's not a question of the testifier, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
Mm-hmm.
A comment on, I am in support of the bill, and I like the provision in here where the commissioner has to identify, or the community has to identify there's a shortage. But my comment is that when we talk about a need for child care and the importance of that and providing assistance, grants, it's being discussed in terms of workforce development and tied to economic development, and I totally agree with that. But when we talk about the metro area, we talk about getting resources to families that are on public assistance, or then those words somehow disappear and is no longer workforce development, or economic development, and it just. To me, common sense that if you get more resources to families, whether it's transportation, housing, food, child care services, that it stabilizes families and then it incentivizes them to actually get more training, maybe go to school, start a business. So it would be good if we could extend this sort of like concept to helping all families, that it is really tied to economic development, workforce development. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Allen. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Baker, I was just wondering, just for some back history, you stated that you have brought this bill to the body since you've been here.
Mm-hmm.
Has you gotten funding each time you have presented a bill?
Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair and members, I have received the $500,000 grant that's been approved each year in the Jobs and Energy Committee. It has moved on. It's been part of the omnibus bill. Our community hasn't actually received anything yet, so we keep pushing it. But I think that the ongoing efforts and the way this program seems to be working really well, I think it has a a bright future, unfortunately, because the need is so great. So I look forward to seeing a better and maybe a bigger, robust program next year when we revisit this during a funding year.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Moran.
So did you state, and I support child care, you know, wholeheartedly, but did you state that, that your community have not received funding?
Representative Baker.
In this list here, I don't see anything like close by that I have right here with me, so I don't see it. But, I mean, our area has and our outlying counties in rural Minnesota, so the money has gone to what I think the commissioners have found the highest need, the greatest return, again, the monies are going to some very good areas of the state.
Well, Mr. Chair, do we have documents of who received funding?
Mm-hmm.
So it's in here somewhere?
Mr. Chair, I don't think you have that number, but I can get that to you, what I have.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Members, there was a report that came out from the department in January that talked about the grant and where it went to and how it was used and how the funding mix and match. We'll get that sent out to everybody so they have a record of that.
Mr. Chair, that'd be great, because some of my question was how many child care received funding, how many programs were maintained and sustained, and so that would be some good information to have.
We'll have it.
Thank you, Representative Moran. Are there any other questions for Representative Baker? Seeing none, final word, Representative Baker.
Thank you, members, for your support.
With that, Representative Baker renews his motion that House File 3605 is re-referred to the Committee on Job Growth and Energy Affordability. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails and House File 3605 is re-referred to the Committee on Job Growth and Energy Affordability. Thank you, Representative Baker. Next up, Representative Albright, who concludes our evening. He has, in this order, House File 3530, 3404, 3575, and 3573. To begin with, Representative Albright moves that House File 3530 is referred to the Committee on Government Operations. We have the bill in front of us, Representative Albright, whenever you are ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. While we're setting up for some technical assistance with the presentation of House File 3530, the bill that is before you, while the name implies something cute, it's no laughing matter. PANDAS is an acronym that stands for Pediatric Autoimmune Neuropsychiatric Disorder. It's commonly referred to and referred with streptococcal infections. It's estimated that PANDAS affects as many as 1 in 200 children. The family that is to my right, your left, suffers greatly from this malady. And so without further ado, I would like to introduce to you the Barnes, Brian and Natalie, who would like to share with you their story of their son and why this legislation, in my opinion, is why we are called as a committee to take care of those that need our help the most. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. and Mrs. Barnes, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Yes, thank you. My name is Brian Barnes, and this is my wife, Natalie Barnes.
Good to meet you all. Thank you for having us.
Thank you for hearing our testimony. We'd like to begin with a short video clip, if that's all right. This is a compilation video. It's about 5 minutes that I put together of our son Parker's journey thus far. Your audio. Put the microphone down the speaker.
Great baby. A wonderful young man. We're very proud of him. He lived with a normal family. In a normal place. Just like normal kids.
That felt good?
Parker's character and nature were stellar.
He's loose.
He's very relaxed. He's organized. January and February of 2017, he began having instant bouts of incapacitating short-lived depression. Small tics started showing up as well. He had a throat clearing that wouldn't go away. It wasn't because he had a cold. Social anxiety crept in. He didn't want to play with others like he did before. We got a note from his teacher. I made an appointment with a psychologist. Then on April 18th, he attempted suicide. He got a one-week stay in an adolescent psychiatric hospital. My wife took an absence from work for 7 weeks to care for him. When we got him out of the psychiatric hospital, they didn't have an answer, so we took him to every pediatrician, general MD, immunologist, chiropractor, neurologist, and psychiatrist we could find. Few had answers, except one thing kept creeping up. Bandits. We started him on anti-inflammatories and antibiotics. They didn't seem to really make much difference because rages soon came on. We required 24-hour care and observation. Psychosis came in, intrusive thoughts. He was a flight risk and would bolt out the door. We couldn't let him be more than 6 inches from us. We followed him everywhere he went in the house, especially if he was anywhere near a door. He was antisocial. Parker, he wouldn't see anybody.
Hurt yourself on the edge right here. Parker.
Obsessive compulsive disorder came in very strong. He lost some of his fine motor skills. He'd always been an artist, and he could no longer control himself. He couldn't even get out of his head, too. He'd only tolerate half days at best for the last month of school. July, after a long battle with our insurance carrier, he started getting IVIG treatments. We saw a good return after the first one. He went in a store again for the first time in a couple of months. We got a smile back, but then it all went away. Speech regression came in. He started speaking in a pattern we call Meville, where he speaks like a three-year-old. Rages came on anew. It was like living on eggshells. He lost his speech entirely on September 14th. We saw more specialists. We even went to the Mayo Clinic. But we were left empty-handed. They had no answers after running every test they had with all their technology. They didn't have any other answer besides pills. We continued to get monthly IVIG infusions. And finally, in October, we started getting real traction. The rages subsided. He gave me a hug again. It was the first time he'd hugged me since June. He typed out that he wanted to play at a friend's house with his siblings. We went in a store in November. He built Legos with his brother. Creativity returned. We went ice skating in December. That was a huge moment. He also began to color and create more often. He began seeing a tutor and occupational therapist in December and became more engaged in each of those sessions. In early January, he started mouthing his words while he hummed and gestured because he still wasn't speaking.
Tell Mom thank you. Look here. That's better. Just give her a thumbs up. How you doing?
By January 8th, he started talking again. That ended 116 days without speech.
Who your friends are that's better? Me? Be very... My food's yourself. Her poop and her...
Each day he continues to improve his speech, his interactions, his creativity, and his schoolwork. It's a long road. We're not out of the woods, but we're getting there. Most doctors don't know about pandas, or if they do, they don't know what to do, and they don't know where to refer. They also don't bother looking it up. Kids are typically referred to an uninformed psychiatrist who puts them on a mixture of antipsychotic medications that exacerbate their symptoms. Psych meds typically make an already difficult condition much worse. These children have been stolen in the night and have little hope of returning if not addressed by an educated professional in a timely fashion.
Cancel the next one. Thank you for listening to that. You've already heard the background on Parker. He's had this disease for about a year now, and he is 11. He'll be 12 in June. In that time, he's experienced OCD, tics, psychosis, suicidal thoughts and actions. He's been a flight risk. He's experienced seizures, locked up in a catatonic state, lost the ability to speak, was admitted to adolescent psychiatric hospital for a week. experienced urinary incontinence, extreme anxiety, screaming rages that go on for hours, loss of appetite, resultant weight loss, and spent days upon days in rhythmic crying state. We put alarms on all of our doors. We locked away all sharp objects in the house by putting them in the safe we installed in the kitchen. And we arranged for 24-hour supervision between my wife and myself and a caregiver, which we paid for out of pocket. My wife typically watched him during the weekdays while I watched over him at night, and I often slept in a chair in front of the door so he wouldn't escape in the middle of the night. This is the reality of severe appendix cases. It's a bear. When this condition strikes a child, the story that ensues is reliable and predictable. It's very consistent. You'll find it almost identical with every parent that has a severe PANDAS child. The first thing you lose is your child. There's a loss of your child. Beaming joy that's been stolen, often literally overnight. And in their place is a similar-looking shell that functions nothing like your child. It's an emotional torture. I practiced this so I wouldn't cry. It didn't work. The next is a logistical stop. Everything in your life stops. Work stops, schedule stops, sports stops, vacation stops, recreation stops, yard work stops, laundry stops, everything stops. Your whole life is flipped upside down instantaneously. Finding qualified medical help is exhausting. Doctors won't advise you of anything over the phone, of course, so you have to make an appointment several days to several weeks away. By the time you get there to the appointment finally, and you've been dealing with a child the whole time, the doctor doesn't know what to do, and they send you away. You have to go through several doctors before you find one that knows what they're doing. This can literally take weeks or months to find competent, qualified help. And then the final battle is the insurance company. Once you find qualified, competent help, and you've rearranged your life, and we have safe care for Parker, and we met all the doctors, eliminated the chaff, and we got a solid diagnosis, and then we're left with a blockade from the insurance company because they don't want to cover the advice treatments for our son, which we have on referral from several different specialists after all the tests. I refer to my wife now, Natalie Barnes.
Thank you all again for having us. I actually am going to speak more to the insurance part of this bill because, of course, I was the one doing a lot of the battling. So committee members and representatives for our state of Health and Human Services, I just thank you for serving your communities. The story of Parker is not one. This happens to so many constituents in your very districts that you represent. This is not as uncommon and rare as you would think. These severe cases are so severe that they are starting to max out, and if they go down the wrong trail of mental health, they don't get the appropriate medical care that they need. So how can you help? I will let you know that I've held a Minnesota State registered nursing license since 1995. My over 20 years of healthcare experience provided me with the knowledge and critical thinking required to battle an insurance company over coverage for our son. Currently, he's scheduled to have repeated IVIG therapies. I, again, like the video said, took 7 weeks off, and this is exactly what I did full-time, was just fight insurance and get him doctors' appropriate care. We have been to over 120 doctor appointments. We have had almost an entire 2 pints, which is a donation pint of blood drawn from an 84-pound 11-year-old. Multiple tests. And he's taken it like a trooper. Again, with the insurance companies, with multiple letters of medical necessity from 3 specialists, supporting documentation from a national consortium of experts printed in the Journal of Adolescent and Psychopharmacology, a total of 114 pages of detailed supporting documentation. And yes, we were denied over and over. We finally obtained coverage ourselves thanks to my self-insured employer, Allina Health. I'm deeply and solely thankful for them. They adopted the guidelines for coverage from Blue Cross Blue Shield. Yes, that is an insurance company. Blue Cross Blue Shield of Texas, Illinois, Oklahoma, New Mexico, and Montana through the end of this year. Not many parents have as much experience, knowledge, and pure grit to battle an insurance company. I have 2 4-inch binders plus more on the side just in documentation. Children that have severe disease are left behind, untreated, suffering. Have any of you known somebody healed of cancer from chemotherapy? What if that life-saving treatment was withheld by their insurance company? These are children. These are our next generation. I literally just returned from an international conference at Columbia University called The Common Threads of Post-Infectious Diseases of the Brain. Talk about the minds of the world, and they even allowed me to talk for a couple moments. If you've ever heard of the book Brain on Fire regarding NNDA encephalitis, it's a fairly popular book. It's very similar to Pandas and Pans, just a different antibody that causes inflammation of the brain. By large consensus of practitioners from all over the world, the agreed upon treatment for severe cases is initially IVIG, which is exactly what Parker is obtaining currently. In June, Pandas Pans will have a billing code with the revised ICD-11 codes. This code will fall under the autoimmune encephalitides, which means, for those of you, of course you're not in the healthcare field necessarily, it just means that there is inflammation in these children's brains, and this happens post-infection. And for Parker, it was strep. For those severe cases, IVIG helps flush out the rogue antibodies in these kids, helping them heal and return them to their childhood. The mandated coverage by the state of Minnesota will bring relief to many constituents in each and every single one of your districts. There are levels of severity. Our son Parker is, of course, one of those severe cases. As Tony mentioned, there's an estimated 1 in 200 kids affected by some level of severity of PANDAS or PANS. It's not every kid that's going to need the actual IVIG, which I'm sure insurance companies get a little afraid of because, you know, anything that's involved in treatment can be costly. But children with severe illness need IVIG. Now, all of you were chosen and voted upon to represent your communities to solve problems. This is a problem. We just ask you to take the challenge. It's easily solved for children inflicted by supporting this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. and Mrs. Barnes, for taking the time to make the trip up here tonight to speak with us. I know it's not that great of a time frame, especially to get through the Twin Cities when you would have had to get here. So I really appreciate that and the ability for you to share your story and give us some of your perspective of what you had to go through. I know it can't be a very easy conversation to have, especially with us, but really appreciate you coming down and are coming up and talking to us about this. Are there any questions for the testifiers? Representative Liebling.
Yeah. Well, good evening, and thank you again for coming and showing us the video. I confess I had never heard of this. Mm-hmm. And, wow.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. Our hearts really go out to you on this. And also your story about dealing with the insurance company, which is something that far too many people are struggling with, even when it's not something as significant as what you went through. And, of course, when you're ill or when somebody you love is ill, the very last thing you need is to have to fight with an insurance company instead of, well, I mean, the video really showed us a little taste of what you were dealing with at the time. So, but the question I have for you is the bill in front of us, what I heard you explaining is something about wanting to have this covered, and the bill in front of us doesn't have anything to do with that. It's an advisory council. But I wanted to hear just a little bit more, if you could, about, you know, did they deny this because they don't cover the IVIG or because they don't know this disease, or kind of what was the rationale you got, and, you know, what are you really looking for here in terms of a remedy?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, let me preface this, but there's actually two bills. House Bill 3530 actually establishes that you're looking at an advisory council. The second one is informational packet in your briefing as well. And the reason that we felt it incumbent to talk to both of those bills tonight is because of the holistic nature of what we're trying to identify and solve. But that bill is held by Commerce currently. And so that bill will be heard in Commerce. But in light of timing and the necessity for hearing it, at least in this committee for deadline, you certainly can peruse the other bill at your leisure. But for informational purposes only, that bill is not before us tonight. But I think in light of the compelling testimony of the Barneses, I think for those that sit on Commerce, such as yourself, you do not sit on Commerce, for those that would be privy to that, I think it's important that they just know that there is another bill pending that would, as Natalie spoke to, obligate insurance companies to undertake a more robust review of these cases.
Did you want to repeat your question, Representative Liebling?
Well, yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that, Representative Albright. I just would just like just a little bit more about kind of what was the roadblock that you – I'm so glad you eventually got some coverage. But, you know, what was it you kept hearing? They didn't know of the disease or they wouldn't cover this therapy or what did you get back from them?
Ms. Barnes.
Okay, thank you. So I was going to say, especially since you said, too, that you've never heard of this. Here I was a nurse for 20 years and had never heard of this. Of course, I worked with mostly adults, and this is mostly a pediatric illness. So part of this actually, and it was inferred in the last portion of the video, was just the lack of knowledge from the physician side of things. So part of that advisory council will actually cover getting education out to the appropriate channels in the healthcare field and also, of course, educational fields, because we have found that we become educators. Quite often we're getting phone calls, at least I'm getting phone calls weekly from doctor's offices, from schools, just to get some information into their hands as to what's going on. And the other thing is that especially having gone to this international conference, one of the things that they actually mentioned, and scarlet or rheumatic fever is something that people think about when they think of strep, correct? Well, one of the things that they actually have come to find is that rheumatic fever has kind of dissipated, and the new bug of strep has actually kind of come forth in this pandas or pans. And instead of affecting the heart, it is now affecting the brain. And so it's actually caused similar to rheumatic fever of the brain. So part of that advisory council is, of course, getting the appropriate experts on board and allow Minnesota to, obviously with the strong healthcare field that we have in the state, be one of those states that actually brings forth the best care for these kids.
Representative Liebling. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. And so when they wouldn't cover it, it was like they just said, we don't know what this is, we've never heard of it, and we don't agree that you need the IVIG therapy? Or
well, an IVIG therapy has been actually given to autoimmune encephalitis for over 20 years, and they were trying to tell us that it was experimental. And yet we actually turned in several research papers and supporting documentation that supports this is first-line treatment for the severe cases.
Yeah.
As well as also letters of recommendation from an immunologist, neurologist, and a pediatrician, and I think a general MD and a psychiatrist, stating that this was the best course of action for this patient. Mm-hmm. It's an example of the roadblock that every pandas parent faces when they get there. It seems like if you're not willing to push it to the nth degree, and we had to, we weren't going to wait for the insurance company to fund our treatment for our son, and we put together a U-Caring page, and family and friends donated $20,000 to get us our first three treatments. We only had enough for three treatments. And then finally, after the third treatment and all of our appeals months later, we finally got it approved, and they kicked in literally with $500 left, and, you know, we got the rest covered going forward. So it's an example of the long battle in front of them, and the fact is most parents will stop when they hear the word no, and the insurance companies know that. And they usually can win their battle if you're persistent enough, but they're so exhausted from everything else they're dealing with, they figure no is no and they stop. And that's the heartbreaking thing. And what happens to the kids is they continue to rot because they don't get the treatment they need. And you don't hear about it. It's in the shadows. But, boy, it's a toll like you can't imagine. So.
And something to add here is that other insurance companies in other states are covering this.
Yes.
So why wouldn't we?
Right.
And that is part of the reason why we actually ended up finally getting treatments from a self-insured company, because I was able to submit that. And that was obviously from legislation that came from the state of Illinois. So just an adjunct to what we've said so far.
Representative Liebling.
Yeah, just thank you, folks, for being here. Thanks for your story.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author and the testifiers. You know, you've got the council, and you're bringing in people that are going to be very energetic, active, and probably fairly knowledgeable. Have you looked at, you know, not part of the council, but bringing in some experts? Because there are things out there, QXMD, male clinic symptoms. There's a Watson-driven diagnostic aid and reference and an AI-type thing. And some of those things are being developed in the state so that it, when something unusual happens, you know, medical professionals don't Google, but they do have a few tools and references that they can tie into so that if you work with those groups, it may assist in getting the communication. And I think some of the Rochester IBM people are connected with the Watson diagnostic, which tends to look at really obscure things and looks at stacked symptoms and, you know, and analyzes to try and diagnose. So, you know, when they're, you know, confused. So I would hope that you've got a great, you know, idea for the council. But try and tie in some of those other, you know, U of M and other people that are used to and they're already instantiated in the data paths that you'll need to utilize to get the information out. And I wish you good luck.
Senator Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Quam. All good ideas and all those will be incorporated into the consideration as we form that advisory council.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just briefly, first of all, I'm sorry, what was your last name?
Barnes,
Mr. Barnes. I wanted to let you know that we cry in here all the time, so you're really in good company. So you never have to apologize for that in this room, because we do hear about some of the hardest things that people have to go through in their lives, and we're asked to help. And I just guess I wanted to communicate to you on behalf of probably all of us here that parents make a big difference, and raising awareness is so vitally important, and the legislature is a really it can be a really good place to do that. But, you know, this idea of creating an advisory council so that we can raise awareness and people can ask the questions sooner rather than later. How long did it take you to hear the word pandas when you were going through all of your testing?
We were actually lucky enough to hear of it within 4 months of him first starting to have his first symptoms, which is huge. However, trying to find then doctors to actually help us out was a huge challenge. But obviously any mom that or dad that's here that loves their kids will do whatever it takes. Mm-hmm. So.
And I'd also like to add on to that in our journey, it was unique that we found out about it so quickly.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of parents will spend years taking their kid to everybody under the sun and a psychiatrist, put their kid on every other pill they can imagine and all the associated side effects, and it makes their kid worse instead of better, and they give them a different pill. And that's the road that typically goes before somebody finally tips the hand that, hey, you should look into pandas. We got that hand tipped to us pretty quickly after his explosive event about a year ago. And that set us on that trail right away, whereas more typically parents will follow a rabbit trail that goes nowhere and spend years in agony doing it. So our son just had an infusion yesterday. There was another child there getting an infusion right next to him for the same condition, and he has had it since he was 4. He is 9 now. So they've been on a journey.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the Barnes family and Representative Albright, and we'll work together and raise some awareness.
Sounds great. Thank you.
Are there any other questions for the Barneses? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony this evening.
Thank you. Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify in House File 3530? Seeing none, final questions from members? Final word, Representative Albright.
Thank you, members.
With that, Representative Albright renews his motion that House File 3530 be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections Policy. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. House File 3530 is re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections Policy. Next up is House File 3404. Representative Albright moves that House File 3404 be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections Policy. Representative Albright, we have the bill in front of us. To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 3404. If you take a look, members, on the second page of the bill, it just extends out the expiration for the TBI Advisory Committee by 5 years.
All right. Is there anyone who wishes to testify in House File 3404? Seeing none, are there questions from members in House File 3404? Final word, Representative Albright.
Thank you.
With that, Representative Albright renews his motion that House File 3404 be referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections Policy. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 3404 is referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections Policy. Next on the agenda is House File 3573. Representative Albright moves that House File 3575 be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections Policy. Representative Albright, to your bill.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Did you speak about 3573 first?
You know, Representative Albright, I said them both. So
I'm
let's...
Just wondering which one I'm confused about.
Which one would you like to move, Representative
Albright? You know what? You're the chair.
All right, Representative Albright moves House File 3573 to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance.
Mr. Chair and members, this is a child care background study bill. This has been thoroughly researched and vetted, and there is, based upon subsequent dialogue between the stakeholders, there is an A1 amendment, and I would like to move that at this time.
Representative Albright moves the A1 amendment. Representative Albright, to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The A1 amendment is the product of the work between all stakeholders to the background checks. We heard a little bit about this in a committee earlier today, but I can assure you that there is, quote-unquote, peace in the valley as it would pertain to this, and I would urge your support.
Are there any questions on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, is there anyone who wishes to testify on the A1 amendment? All right. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name once again for the committee and present your testimony.
Members of the committee, my name is Julie Seidel. I'm the public policy director for MACCP and a licensed child care provider. Fingerprinting on minor children is unnecessary. They already go through a comprehensive background study every single year. These studies are so thorough that our children can be disqualified without ever having been convicted or even charged with a crime. There are Minnesota teachers working in our classrooms who would not pass the background studies our children go through right now. They exceed federal requirement and are more than sufficient to protect children enrolled in licensed care. Children 13 years of age and older who are enrolled in our program are exempt from background studies, even though as child care children themselves, they have continual direct contact with other daycare children. DHS has recognized the need to protect the rights and privacy of those. Why are the rights and privacy of my child worth even less, though she rarely has any contact with daycare children due to school and extracurricular activities. Why are children of family child care providers all viewed as potential threats, while other children in the same age in the program have their rights protected? MACCP has heard from many of our members and non-members who intend to close their doors if this is not repealed. The continual loss of family child care forces more and more children into unlicensed, unregulated care where there are no background studies for anyone. Instead of protecting children, this policy has placed more and more children at risk and in harm's way. We believe this repeal is more than fair. The federal government and many other states do not require any background studies for minors living in a child care home. Minnesota has seen the need for the safety measures that go above and beyond federal standards, and that's exactly what our current annual background studies do without fingerprints and photographs. This repeal will maintain Minnesota's high safety standards while protecting the privacy and rights of all children, not just those enrolled in care. I hope this bill gets bipartisan support from this committee today. We have already heard from several providers who have quit because they refuse to subject their children to a fingerprint background study and were unwilling to wait for the outcome of this legislative session. Bipartisan support would give providers hope that positive change is coming and hopefully keep some providers from closing their doors. Thank you for your time this evening.
Thank you, Ms. Seidel, for your testimony. Are there any questions for the testifier? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a quick comment. If I was in your position, if I was a home care, daycare provider, and I had a child, I'd feel exactly the same way. So thank you.
Any other questions for the testifier? Seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on the A1 amendment? All right. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Madison Seidel. I'm 15 years old. I live and go to school in Anoka County. I'm here today to ask you to protect my privacy and my rights and the rights and privacy of all the kids living in child care homes. My mom is a licensed family child care provider. There's a lot of responsibilities and stress for children who live in family child care homes. Sometimes, as simple as forgetting to put hair products away could result in a violation and fine. Leaving dirty dishes in the sink could result in a violation. Having a bobby pin fall out of my hair in the child care space could result in a violation. It's a scary feeling to know that if I make a simple mistake, my mom could lose her job, which would result in us losing everything. Now, DHS is telling me that on top of all the restrictions, requirements, and background checks I'm already subjected to, I need to be fingerprinted and photographed like a criminal, or my mother will lose her job. How can they place that kind of choice on a 13- to 17-year-old kid who has done nothing wrong? I'm a good kid. I don't get in trouble at school, and I've never broken the law. I get good grades and participate in my school's dance team. I already passed strict background checks that exceed federal requirements. If I was a criminal, I would understand being fingerprinted, but I'm not. I hope you repeal this requirement to protect the rights and privacy of children like me, whose only crime is having a mother who provides licensed child care for the families in our community.
All right, Ms. Seidel, thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions for the testifier? Okay, seeing none, the committee thanks you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Albright, to your bill as amended.
Members, the amended House File 3573 that you have before you stands on its own merits, and I think the testimony that you've heard, it's fairly compelling, so I would urge your support.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 3575? Final questions from members? 3573, Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to clarify again with Representative Albright. Right now, if we pass this bill so that we don't do the fingerprints and the photographing and send the stuff off to the FBI, The department can still do a just look to make sure that the people in the home are, don't have some background. I mean, they can do the so-called name and date of birth check, right? And they do that anyway. So it's not like we pass this bill and then there's absolutely nothing. It just gets rid of the – because I remember when these background checks, when we made the transition over to the new system, that one of the things that happens is that the FBI keeps this forever, I think. And that's really problematic. So I think it's a good bill. Thank you for bringing it.
Final word, Representative Albright.
Brevity is my friend.
With that, Representative Albright renews his motion that House File 3573, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, and House File 3573, as amended, is referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. Finally, tonight, House File 3575, Representative Albright. Representative Albright moves that House File 3575 be referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections Policy. Representative Albright, two-year bill.
Mr. Chair, members, I will leave you only with the paragraph that House Research so ably put together. This bill establishes a Human Services Department Restructuring Working Group to consider restructuring the Department of Human Services to provide for better coordination and control of programs, accountability, and continuity. The working group is required to submit a report with findings, recommendations, and draft legislation to the legislative committees with jurisdiction over human service policy and finance, and I would urge your support.
Representative Albright, you have the A1 amendment. Would you like to move the A1 amendment?
Mr. Chair, I don't have an A1 amendment.
Representative Liebling, you have the A1 amendment.
Oh, right. Yes, I do, Mr. Chair.
Would you like to move your A1 amendment?
Yeah, I'll move the A1 amendment. The A1 amendment just adds a member representing the Cultural and Ethnic Communities Leadership Council, appointed by the Commissioner of Human Services. So I think that the idea was just that, that we ought to, that we have this, we have this group that's working to on healthcare disparities. It's been working very diligently, and it just seemed like if we're gonna have this group and be thinking about what we're gonna do with the Department of Human Services, that we ought to include them.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, I want to thank you for bringing this amendment forward. I think it is a good and effective addition to the advisory working group, and so I would urge your member support of the Liebling amendment.
Is there anyone who wishes to testify on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, are there any questions on the A1 amendment? With that, Representative Liebling renews her motion to adopt the A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Albright, two-year bill as amended.
Mr. Chair, it's been a night. Let's close it out on a strong note.
Okay. Right.
Is there anyone who wishes to testify on House File 3575? Seeing none, final questions from members? Seeing none, Representative Albright renews his motion that House File 3575, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections Policy. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion is adopted, and House File 3575, as amended, is referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections Policy. With that, members, we are adjourned. Amen.